You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today we are rebroadcasting Civil War in Libya from August 31st, 2011, recorded during the NATO attack on Libya. Let's see if Mohammed Hassan's analysis of the situation and probable outcome of the takedown of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya proved to be prescient.
This is Guns and Butter.
The U.S. policy is simple. If you cannot control, blow it up. And that's what they are doing in Libya. It has nothing to do with liberating the Libyan people. In fact, on the contrary, destroying all the infrastructure of Libya, bringing the most gangsters element, considering them as a legitimate government, and putting them on the top of the Libyan people, and they can also can hassle and control the Libyan people, will be very difficult task. They might overthrow the government of Libya, but they will not have Libya stable.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Mohammed Hassan. Today's show, Civil War in Libya. Mohammed Hassan is a specialist in geopolitics and the Arab world. Born in Ethiopia, he participated in the student movements of the 1974 Socialist Revolution in his country. He studied political science in Egypt before specializing in public administration in Brussels. A diplomat for his country of birth during the 1990s, he has worked in Washington, Beijing, and Brussels. Co-author of Iraq Under the Occupation, he has also participated in producing works on Arab nationalism and the Islamic movements and on Flemish nationalism. Today's interview was taped on August 25th. Mohammed Hassan, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
You did an interview with Investigating Action in March of 2011 entitled Libya, Popular Uprising, Civilian War, or Military Attack. It's now August 25th, 5 months later. Which characterization do you think now is the most accurate?
The most accurate it is the third one, that igniting civil war. And the second one also, that it is it a rebellion or not? This now become very clear. If you look back into the modern history, at least from the 1930s and 40s, when the Nazi Germany invaded the Soviet Union in 1941, it had prepared also, it's not only Nazi Germany's propaganda and its army have invaded the Soviet Union, but also they have put in an objective, another, using different groups who are pro-Nazi and pro-fascist elements from the previous exiled element in Germany and outside. And they have created what they call liberation fronts. For example, Russian Liberation Front, which is led by General Volosov, a guerrilla movement. Then you have the right-wing Ukrainian Liberation Front and so on. So even when they have captured some PWOs of Soviet army and soldiers, they try to divide them on the basis of their nationality, because the Soviet Union is a lot of languages and a lot of different nationalities live. And they divide them, and they want them to join these so-called liberation fronts. The objective was that it is Nazi Germany's objective is to fight against communism and to liberate the people of the Soviet Union. This strategy and this tactic which the Nazis have perfected is now what United States it is using it. To give an illustration and to put my argument to have a foundation, it is an American professor himself who wrote a book in the 80s, Christopher Simpson, Blue Bag, America's Recruitment of Nazis and Its Effect on the Cold War. So what United States in fact did in the time of Kennan and their policy of containment, the purpose is that to learn from the German and Nazi experience and how to combat the Soviet Union. So they have in fact copied and recruited ex-Nazis and integrate them In fact, even the founder of the CIA, it's not only Alan Dulles, but also is the German Nazi who have been imported from Germany after it surrendered. All these techniques and all this, they have learned it from the documents and with the collaboration of the ex-Nazi officers. Now to come back to our situation in Libya. Libya is a big country. As you know, most of African countries are a creation of colonialism. And Libya once had been a walaya or a province of the Ottoman. Then finally, with the inter-imperialist contradiction between France and Germany, that it is Germany wanted to have Tunis, already France is already in Algeria, Germany wanted to have also Morocco. With this contradiction, finally, that what men calls the famous conference of the Bismarck, what they call the Balkanization of colonization of Africa, the Berlin Conference was made. So Libya, later on, that it is Britain, have encouraged the weakest force in this imperialist force, Italy, and Italian imperialism wanted to have Libya. So by 1911, Italy have invaded Libya. In that time, Libyan people, they are very minority. They don't even constitute 1 million, about 800,000. Diverse, there is no road, there is no infrastructure, and so on. Despite of that, it is for the first time that it is the Libyan tribes sat and discussed, and they said, we will not accept colonialism, and they made a united front and fought against the Italians, which is known by, called Omar Mukhtar, as representing as the leader. Later on, when the Italian fascists, because as you know that Italy also have tried to colonize my country, Ethiopia, Abyssinia, and it was defeated by 1896. So element of Italian fascist intelligentsia from 1910 on was writing a lot of articles and saying that the honor of white man was broken in Africa and we have to replace the white man honor and so on. And this was the embryo later on for the fascist movement in Italy, and gradually with Mussolini taking over the power. But despite of all this is that it is the Libyan resistance continued, and Italy, then the Italian fascists, after they took over power, with all the equipment they have and the material they have, in comparison with the Libyans who have been not exposed to modern weapon and they are little bit, you could say they are primitive in a sense that it is primitive, they didn't have the modern weapons to struggle, but despite of that, they continued fighting. The Nazis, the fascists, were killing every month almost about 28,000, and it took them a very long time to defeat the resistance. This is why I'm saying and why I'm explaining that the Libyans had an independent psychology. They wanted to be independent. They don't want to be under any other hegemony. Once resistance defeat, Italian settlers came at the coast and tried to took the best land and so on and impose. Finally, the Second World War came, which is Italy was defeated, and Britain in the north, and from the south, France occupied Libya.
In 1951, Libya became independent of colonial rule, made up of three different regions. Did Libya become a nation state at independence?
By 1951, through the UN, Libya got independence. It was the poorest country in Africa. Once Libya got independent and the King Idris came to power, it was a very disorganized country in real sense. Modernization was very, very limited, except at the cost. About 40,000 Italian settlers, they were there. And there is a segment of modern type of society developed in this area, where a small intelligentsia have developed, and a small bourgeoisie, which is comprador bourgeoisie or merchant bourgeoisie, you could call, within the Libyan society, have emerged. But finally, the king, which had been an ally of Britain in the time of the resistance of Omar Mukhtar itself, he ran away to Egypt, and then he surrendered himself to the British intelligence. By that moment, Egypt was under indirect control of Great Britain. Then the British sponsored him and brought him and wrote him a constitution called Federal Constitution, and they put him in power. And then United States and Britain had a military base. And the only way of the Libyan government at that moment or the kingdom to survive was by giving them assistance from outside.
How have oil prices influenced the history of the Arab world?
Once is oil discovered by the U.S. multinationals, particularly from Texas, and later on big other multinationals discovered, the revenue of the country was increased. Gradually, a little bit urbanization came, but the Libyan oil was sold at the cheapest price. At that moment, one barrel of oil of all other countries who are producing from Venezuela until the Gulf countries, it was sold by 90 U.S. cents. But Libyan oil, which is the most expensive, the cleanest one, it was sold 30 cent per barrel. So Libya became de facto a new colony with a false flag and with a false government.
In 1969, three colonels overthrew King Idris. What role has the military played in Libya?
The only organized group within the Libyan society became the army. And from this army that the young officers who have been coming from the lowest class of the society, like Gaddafi and his friend, later on took over the power by making a coup, and they call it a revolution, and they took over the power in September 1969. And their assumption and logic and their ideology was based on Nasserism, that Nasser was ruling by that moment Egypt, and they wanted a unity with Egypt based on Arab nationalism and Arab unity, and to unite Egypt and Libya as a first step, and gradually maybe the other Arab countries who are willing to join this coalition to create a very big market, to be independent from the imperialist forces, and to use the resources and to use also Egyptian human resources for Libyan development, because Libya have a very thin population and it is a very fast country.
What do you know about the Libyan opposition? Is this a very disparate group?
If you look at the group now, which is supported by NATO, are three groups. One group is that it is Al-Qaeda group, which elements from Al-Qaeda, some young people who went and fought in Afghanistan against the United States, and who came back to their villages and who have some training and experience in combating in Afghanistan. This is one of the Al-Qaeda group. The second group is when Libya had a contradiction with Chad, and some Libyan soldiers had been captured in Chad by Hussein Habre, and he sold them to United States, and the United States took them, it is in the era of Reagan, and brought them first to certain African countries, and finally brought them to United States, and was supported and trained by Langla, the CIA, and were kept until today. Most of them, they became very old, but one of the leaders now of the so-called Liberation Front, it is this CIA-trained officers who have been captured in the time of the Chad War. The other group is that it is themselves who have been in government and in Libya for a very long time, and some of like the Minister of Justice and the one who have been killed, Minister of Interior and all others. This had been corrupt element, in fact, and several years back there was a discussion in Libya, and they have created with a young Libyan woman jurist anti-corruption commission, and there was a lot of file on them and a lot of evidence. She was making and collecting all the evidences in order to bring them to court. So it is one of the first bombardment NATO did, in fact, attacking that department, particularly the files and archive of this anti-corruption commission. So this one's the one who have now defected and joined. One of them, of course, who was killed, joined. These are civilians who have been in the government, some of them, one who is an officer, who are, of course, they think in terms of secular. This is another group. They are individuals. The other the third group, it is some businessmen who have, in the last 10 years of the policy of being accommodating with the Western companies and so on, and they also have taken a lot of loan from the National Bank of Libya and got a lot of wealth in their hand, and they have a vision to liberalize the country absolutely and to minimize the state intervention. So their interest is that is to integrate into neoliberal policy and at the same time to loot the country and to minimize the role of the state. And this is impossible because the majority of the Libyans and the government of Libya have rejected. And plus, they are very corrupt individuals. They are not even a real businessman in a sense of businessmen, but these are compradors who want to accumulate wealth, and they didn't also refund their debt. These ones also defected, and they went to Masrata. Most of them are also from Masrata. They are business people. These three combinations are called, there are 60 individuals. You can divide them, and the most active of them, they don't even meet regularly. The most active and who are interested a little bit in politics, about 13 individuals. The others are interested only on their pockets. They have no long-term vision for the country. They have no any political program for their country. They are thinking in terms of the personal interest. So this all group together, that it is suddenly that it is the defeat, that there is the Islamist also, which I have mentioned, they have tried to kill Gaddafi several times, which they didn't succeed. And then in the name of so-called Arab Revolution, they ignited a small demonstration, which is not even a demonstration, and turned into an armed groups. And this armed group, which have been supported, fed, and protected by U.S. and France and Great Britain, in order to use them as the Nazis have used General Vlasov, the Ukrainian fascist, Romanian fascist, name it, against the Soviet Union and other movements in the 40s. Now they are a carbon copy utilizing the same situation. Those who have no any vision for their country. Some of them even they are very backward and they have no any agenda for their country, and they have a vision of almost of the Middle Ages. Their position is that to put the Libyan woman into the Middle Ages back.
I'm speaking with author and journalist Mohammed Hassan. Today's show, Civil War in Libya. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. How would you characterize the Gaddafi revolution? Could you talk about the influences on Gaddafi?
That since the revolution in Libya, there is a great transformation. Libya was a very primitive and tribal society. And since Gaddafi's regime took over, it improved the health condition, it improved the education, it improved the life of the population, urbanization increased, nation building have been integrating. In fact, before the invasion, that it is the UN Human Rights Commission and others, they wanted to give a medal to Libya for her achievement. When you take, for example, Libya and you compare Libya with Egypt, or you compare Libya with all neighboring countries as far as health is concerned, or you look the index, which is even the UN have published it, that Libya have better situation Libyans have than Saudi Arabia itself, where there is not even a constitution, it's a family government, where women even they cannot drive a car and so on. So Libya was targeted to reverse this achievement in the name of using Arab revolution.
Why does the U.S. want the Gaddafi government overthrown?
I think what happened is, and why is Libya targeted, it's several reasons. From my understanding is there is several reasons. One is Libya is the biggest country in Africa, geographically. Secondly, the Libyan policy or the Libyan government policy on Africa. Libya is the only country where Arabs have a clear vision for Arab unity, at the same time for African unity. Libya's strategic position, Libya have 1,900 kilometer Mediterranean coast. Libya also connects three continents, Europe, Africa and Asia. But Libya have also strategical wells, whether you call it gas and oil. Probably also when I was in Libya twice, several Libyan specialists have told me also there is a possibility of even indication that Libya will have a very good, a very big reserve of gold. Libyan policy after 1990, and particularly after 2000, the anchor of the policy was to build the strong African Union. As a result of that, you see in Libya, just before the destabilization of Libya, 1,200,000 Egyptians, they were working there. About 850,000 Tunisians, they were working. 550,000 Algerians. and almost 1,400,000 black Africans they were living, or about almost 4 million Africans are working in Libya. And these African laborers, they are not exploited in the way that the laborers in the Gulf who are living, Asian laborers, their condition is almost in a slave situation. If you take, for example, that it is the domestic woman, Ethiopian, a lot of Ethiopians are working as domestic in the Arab countries, in the Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Jordan, Lebanon, and so on. They are in a slave situation. They took their passport from them, the families who are working. Most of the time, they don't even pay them. They don't allow them to go out. And if you now just look and you just Google in the internet, you see that a lot of Ethiopian girls who have come in there because of the poverty and the policy of the government, which is a policy of dehumanizing the Ethiopians in general, a lot of Ethiopian girls are committing suicide. When I was in Libya, I discussed with a lot of black African communities from Cameroon, from Nigeria, from Chad, from all Africa, women and men. In Libya, every Libyan, including the immigrant Africans who are working, health is free. You don't pay anything. You go to the hospital if you are sick. If my wife, for example, me, I'm living there with my family and my wife, she is delivering, I bring her to hospital. I don't pay even a penny. My children go to school free. Electricity and water is free. Most of the Africans who are working there, and I made an interview with them, they said, I asked them, some of them from Cameroon, some of them from Nigeria. I said, Nigeria is a very rich country inhabited by poor people. Cameroon is a very rich country inhabited by poor people. Most of African countries are rich countries inhabited by poor people. I'm living in Belgium, a very small dependent imperialist country, but it's a poor country inhabited by rich people. Itself, it's a contradiction. What Libya did is that it reversed the table. And these citizens from different African countries, which I discussed with them, they have businesses, their own businesses. You don't need even a permission. There is no red tape. You have the same right as any Libyan. And this forging a unity among the masses of Africans, in one sense. The vision of Gaddafi that it is Libya is not only an Arab country, but so is an African country. 40% of the Libyans are black. They look like Somalis or other African countries. And integrating this diversity into one, saying that, yes, Libya is an Arab country, a Muslim country, a Sunni country. At the same time, also, Libya is an African country. There is no racism among the Libyans. The hospitality among the Libyans is very, very progressive. Their thinking is very open. Most of the young people I meet, they are born after the revolution. And before, Libya was a very, very, very poor country. I remember a friend of my father is a Libyan who used to work in Ethiopia. When I was very young, and he used to tell me that the level of the poverty of, among the Libyans, it is a desert, there is nothing, there is no road. This is before the discovery of the oil. So what the Libyan government did under Muammar Gaddafi, it transformed this society. It brought them to a level of civilization. Every Libyan have a house, have a car, have health system. Even if when they finish university, and a girl or a boy who have finished university, they wanted to marry, they get each of them, in order to settle, each of them, they get 16,000 euro. I don't think it's the richest country in the world, as they tell us, that American citizens will get that in order to settle. Or no European countries will do that. But Libyans had the most comfortable life when I compare it with a lot of countries, including Belgium, including Switzerland. That is, Libya, it is used for their own sources. The first time when I went there and I saw the infrastructure, I was surprised. The propaganda outside is that it is led by a dictator. Well, if this dictator, as they call it, is improving the life condition of the people, not only them, including the immigrants who are working there in the country and they have the same rights, well, I would like to live under this dictator than an African origin president of United States, which United States, that is 35% of the population have no health. A big part, 35 million of American citizens, they are living under the standard of Bangladesh. The majority of American people now, through the crisis and the abuse they did in the last 10 years on the American economy, that it is a lot of families have lost their properties. They are in tents. The people who have been, 1 million people who have, because of the crisis, or it is the weather conditions in one part of the United States, and they have left their houses. Still, they live now in refugee camps, like other refugees, like Palestinian refugees in Lebanon. This situation is not there in Libya.
What is your view of what is referred to as the Arab Spring, generally in Tunisia and Egypt?
What shocked them, according to me, is the unexpected popular uprising in Egypt. I went to Egypt in 2008. After 29 years, I have been in Egypt and I studied in Egypt. And I just wanted to check what's happening in this country in 2008. When I arrived there, I started talking. There was a Somali Student Association in the center. I went there and there was an Egyptian man who used to provide us tea. His name is Mohammed, and I talked to him. He remembered me. And I said, in Arabic, give me, how is the situation here? Then he started shouting. He said, this country is ruled by mafia, Isaba, gangsters. I was surprised. I asked him, are you really, this is your opinion, or you are trying to mislead me? Then he continued his speech. In 3 days my stay in Egypt, I realized that this country is in the verge of a popular uprising. One, Mubarak was ruling the country for 30 years in a military decree. Secondly, the systematical destruction of Egypt, particularly since Sadat and later on Mubarak. Egypt, when I was in the time of the Nasser's legacy in 1970, 85% of internal consumption food was produced inside Egypt. Today, 100% is dependent from outside. 50% of Egyptian budget is only allocated to Cairo today. About 6 provinces of Egyptian provinces, the people are living in a miserable situation. 3 of the provinces, they only eat once in a day, and the other 3 or 4 provinces, they only eat once every 2 days. The number of suicide in Egypt, to give you an illustration, if you check the journal called the Chicago Tribune, in 2008, published that in Egypt, university graduates, young university graduates, 10,679 university graduates, they couldn't find a job and they committed suicide. Egypt was ruled by a comprador corrupt elements who systematically destroyed their own country and deindustrialization, looted the walls and accumulated to very few families, turned the country into an import-export shop, and they destroyed every self-reliance which have been built, and all the other industries in the past. Egypt was self-sufficient in textile because it had cotton. Egypt had a sophisticated textile industry when I was studying. Egypt had a very good industry in pharmaceutical industry. Egypt had also a lot of other consumer commodities. All this has been destroyed. Now everything is imported from outside by this comprador merchant mentality, and the country's flag and the country's sovereignty have been destroyed. Egyptian army became a mercenary army. In fact, Egyptian army doctors are now the one who are treating of the American and NATO soldiers wounded in Afghanistan. So the condition in Egypt was terrible. You go to the rural areas, you will be surprised at the misery. The peasants who got in the land reform land democratically, it was taken from them, and the feudal classes and the old owners, they were given to them. And they are only producing or farming something they want to sell in the market very quick, fruits and other things, vegetables, clearly allocated exclusively to the elite and so on. Egyptian state, it is a policy state. There is 1,600,000 police and security dominating the country. Wherever you go, it is there is securities, whether it is in uniform and non-uniform. And you see the miserable condition of the country. 30 years under a military decree was ruled. The most populous African country, the most populous Arabic country, which had a very strong technical class, highly intellectuals, specialists in all sense of it, but became a miserable country. When the popular uprising and the spontaneous popular uprising happened, you see the behavior of the United States, particularly President Obama and Secretary of State. They couldn't even comment. They were not even discussing that this is the right of the Egyptian people. What they said, that they don't want to intervene.
Yes, and that's right. I remember that. I'm speaking with author and journalist Mohammed Hassan. Today's show, Civil War in Libya. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. What are the geostrategic advantages of Libya that makes it a prime target of imperialism?
So why then they intervene in Libya? Why they want to intervene in Syria? This is my second thinking is the geographical position of Libya. Libya have 1,900 kilometer coast, the biggest Mediterranean coast. One wants to control that. Second, of course, the oil and the market, but the most important is to control and to have a military base in Libya. Because United States, after the collapse of Eastern Europe in 1989, the U.S. designed a policy for the continent. By that moment, it is immediately 1990, Clinton coming to power and to presidency, and Anthony Lake developed a theory which is called how to control Africa. You need to have the anchor states. And he divided Africa into four zones. North Africa, from Egypt to Mauritania, the anchor state will be Egypt. Through Egypt, will influence this area. For West Africa, is Nigeria was dominated, and Nigeria will be the anchor state. And we have seen the Nigerian intervention in Liberia. We have seen the Nigerian intervention in Sierra Leone. Then they said for the greater Horn of Africa and East Africa, the anchor state will be Ethiopia. And we have seen the intervention of Ethiopian troops in Somalian crisis, and they are even defeated. And for Southern Africa, the anchor state will be South Africa, they said. At that moment, it was President Mbeki was leading. This is the theory of Anthony Lake. He says, through these anchor states, we will control Africa. And his plan for Africa, United States will be engaged in Africa in one thing, he says. One, food security, just to pump American food as food aid through U.S. aid and so on. Not food in the sense that Africans can mobilize their own resources. Africa is a rich continent while inhabited by poor population. Africa has everything. So instead of mobilizing the population and having to stand in their own two feet and to decide their own sovereignty, no. We'll send them food, and food aid will be our main object. And the third is to fight or what he called to combat AIDS or HIV. This was the advisor of Clinton was considering the role of United States will be in Africa. Immediately after him, after Anthony Lake's vision, Parameter, the U.S. Journal called Parameter, where important officers of the U.S. Army discuss foreign policy outside of United States. Parameter, which is a journal of Department of Defense, published in 1994 a very long document on Africa. And it says like this, Africa is a very rich continent, and it has a lot of minerals, agriculture, water, and he classifies it, and he puts the whole map in this document. If you can find it and check Parameter 1994 90, or end of 93 nine, and beginning of 94, you will see the document. The document says, after the demise of the Soviet Union and the socialist regimes in Eastern Europe, United States, by combating or fighting an anti-communist and Cold War that United States militarily won or politically won, but he says United States also economically weakened. It has spent all its resources in combating and fighting the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe and all other nationalist governments since 1945 and 50s. Therefore, Africa is very important for us, and new competitors are now coming up, and he's mentioning Japan at that moment. It's not the European Union. And in this document says Africa is the richest continent. It has all these resources, and we have to design a mechanism to stop Japan to enter into Africa. And he classifies and he puts what strategies must be implemented in order to block Japan for not entering in Africa or having an influence in Africa. One of the things is that it is to develop military-to-military relationship with African army, one, which is means infiltrate, bring these officers to United States, train them, and so on, which is means infiltrate this army, put your stooges inside, prepare them. When it is necessary, they will also make a coup if it is our line is not appreciated. Second is police agreement, which is means a bilateral relation, a multilateral relation with the different countries to train police officers, bring the police officers in the police academy, and so on, because police is the closest segment of the security to the people, and so on. So infiltrate this police and make sure that your stooges in this police will have a stronger position and a strategical position that if a danger comes, they can ally with the officers and they can overthrow. The third pillar, which they are putting necessary, is that NGOs, which is the non-governmental organizations. These non-governmental organizations are two types. One, they call them the civil society. You come in with money and with land cruisers and so on. You open an office, and then you check around. And if you find some elegant young people and so on, you recruit them. And then you a little bit give them a better salary and so on. And they do small projects and so on. But in fact, they collect information. And of course, also work to show that it is these NGOs, small is beautiful, and weakening the government. The role of government must be limited. African governments, there must be only an arbiter, as if that it is two football teams are playing in the stadium, and you have an arbiter who is guiding the football. A government, a national government, should not intervene, for example, in mobilizing the population and creating a sense of nation building is a very difficult thing. So to build a nation building, to encourage the youth to come together in order to enhance the development, use your human resources, create unity among the people. Most of African countries, because of their diverse languages, diverse religion, and so on, you have to forge a unity among these people and among the youth particularly. And the purpose of these NGOs and the civil society segment is to break and weaken the fabric of the society by mushrooms of NGOs. For example, my country, it have more NGOs than per capita, subsidized by their own governments. But if you read Spy Catcher, he himself is a spy, published a book in late 1980s. He explained how the intelligence service, like the MI5, the MI6, infiltrate in these so-called NGOs and so-called even UN organizations like FAO and so on, collect data and so on, and weaken the structure and the body of that country. This is one of the pillars also which Anthony Lake and that document, the U.S. policy was on Africa. The purpose is that to destabilize, weaken, divide that country in order to control them. This is the strategy of the United States. The Libyan leadership developed Arab-African policy. It entered South-South policy. It used the resources for their own. Not only that, the Libyan government have been very generous for a lot of countries by providing them assistance. To give you, since the war started in Libya, the aggression against Libya, Djibouti, where there is no American military base there, the population in Djibouti are suffering. Why they are suffering? All the oil for electricity was coming from Libya, subsidized by Libya. That the ordinary people in Djibouti is suffering because of the invasion against Libya, that the Libyan solidarity was broken. This is Libya's role in the continent. So once the popular revolt happened in Egypt and their puppet regime is at least the head collapsed, The Tunisian popular revolt and the dictatorship of this country collapsed, there is a panic came within the interest group or within the North. So they have to invent a new revolution, which is a counter-revolution, one against Libya and the second against Syria. And as we see now, NATO, these ragtags, if you read Foreign Affairs, which is the American journal itself, about several months just when the so-called Libyan issue was started, if you read that, the Foreign Affairs itself says, these are ragtags who have no any vision. They are just mercenaries, utilized. Some of them even, they are not Libyan, they are foreigners. As you see now, when they have entered to Tripoli, they brought some gangs who speak Arabic from outside, paid them, and then other elements, with the support of special troops from Great Britain and France and so on, they brought them through the sea and smuggled them to the capital. And with the bombardment of NATO, now you see they are looting the city and killing.
What about AFRICOM, the African Command, now headquartered in Stuttgart? Will AFRICOM be playing a big role in the future of Libya?
The objective is for United States and NATO is simple. For United States is to build a big military base for AFRICOM. AFRICOM is a NATO for Africa, which United States have a plan that wants to dominate the world, according to them, but which is most of African countries has refused to give any military base to AFRICOM. Using now their strategy is that to overthrow the government in Libya, put their puppet, bring back the military base which have been kicked in the 1970s after the Libyan revolution. And Libya, because it is a very big country, you can control the Mediterranean. You can also control the other African countries. It have border with a lot of African countries. And this AFRICOM will be the main pillar of the U.S. strategy for Africa. The U.S. policy is simple. If you cannot control, blow it up. And that's what they are doing in Libya. It has nothing to do with liberating the Libyan people. In fact, on the contrary, destroying all the infrastructure of Libya, bringing the most gangsters element, considering them as a legitimate government, and putting them on the top of the Libyan people, and they can also can hassle and control the Libyan people, will be very difficult task. They might overthrow the government of Libya, but they will not have Libya stable. To give you an illustration, I just got today an email from a Tunisian friend who have left from Tunisian border, and he reached Tripoli this morning. And he sent me a very long email. Most of the cities from the border of Tunis until Tripoli still is in the hand of the government of Libya. Zawiya is in the hand of the government of Sarman, and all. He wrote it in details. And he says also about in Tripoli, he said that it is a lot of media propaganda and a lot of exaggeration. To tell you that it is Goebbels propaganda is going on, at one time yesterday, the BBC, which is considered a respected information organization, they showed in the television using a false picture, a picture which is not about Libya. They just took a picture from India and they just said that there was a big number of Indians. Probably it was in the election time, the Indians taking their flag and a lot of them coming out in a very green area and so on. And they showed that this is the support of the Libyan people for the liberation of Tripoli. It's absolutely fake.
I'm speaking with author and journalist Mohammed Hassan. Today's show, Civil War in Libya. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Well, that's interesting. What else did the email from your friend, your Tunisian friend, what else did he say?
He says these ragtags, so-called revolutionaries, when there is no bombardment, they disappear. Once the NATO bombardment starts, they appear. And most of the time, they are, I don't know, maybe they are sleeping in the day and they are not, they are protecting themselves, they are hiding. But what is happening now, he said, is that every part of every commune and every area of Tripoli reorganized itself and put that self-defense mechanism to protect their homes, to protect their business, to protect themselves. and trying also to discover who are from outside by stopping the cars, asking the identity card. He says that he was walking in the center of the city and he didn't see them. So the propaganda now, if you look on all the televisions, they are concentrating on Bab al-Azizia. And they are saying that it is Gaddafi and his son, they have disappeared. They are in the tunnel. They are opening doors there and there. We are checking and so on. They don't show you the capital itself. They don't show you the population. They don't show you any movement. They don't show any testimonies. They are, in fact, repeating the same propaganda, the same pictures. So the on the ground, the balance of forces on the ground is totally different. If this Tunisian can travel from the border, from Tunis, the whole night, and arriving in the morning to Tripoli, he says, it is true, it is not the same. We have taken the same way when we were together twice. He said that the last time when we were there, the checkpoints were not so much. Now he said, yes, there is a lot of checkpoints. They check the cars, they stop you everywhere, they ask, they inquire. And most of them are the popular forces of the region and the Libyan army, who's controlling. And he arrived to the capital. But they told us in the news that the so-called revolutionaries have closed this road, that the high officials of Gaddafi government, of Gaddafi regime, cannot escape to Tunisia, which is not true. The issue is very simple. There will be a lot of propaganda the coming weeks and months. But the struggle in Libya will be a very long struggle. So United States, again, for the third time, for the fourth time, another Muslim country, destabilized and brought it into civil war. They did in Somalia, then Iraq, then Afghanistan, and now Libya. And none of their objectives they have achieved. In Afghanistan, they are spending and squandering the American public money, and their strategical objective, it's not realized. Take even the puppet government of Karzai, in one of the mines in Afghanistan, was given to the Chinese company. Chinese, without shooting one bullet, are winning the contracts. In Iraq, the same. It's only Esso, American multinational oil company, had won the auctions. Probably also will be in the future in Libya. The same. Squandering the American working people's wealth. In fact, as the British historian Paul Kennedy said, the rise and decline of great power. United States literally is a declining power. It has a very strong military. It consumes more. In fact, if your economy is not dynamic, if your production capacity doesn't support your military adventure, then you are a declining power. And United States is a declining power, and it is also an adventure. What they did in Libya. It's an adventure and it is a panic. I see it from a panic. It's not even a well-studied one. One, they created contradiction within the hate among the Libyans. To give you one illustration, the so-called revolutionaries captured the black Libyan in Benghazi. I met the family, the father and the mother and so on. And let me tell you about that. His name is Hisham. He is from somewhere about 80, 90, 100 kilometers from Tripoli. He left and he went to Benghazi. He left on Thursday. Thursday night, after he arrived there, he called to his mother and he said that I have arrived in peace, it's okay, my mother, don't worry. And he talked to his father and to his brothers and sisters, even to his fiancée. On Friday, when this problem happened, he was captured. And they are asking him, you are a foreigner, because this is the media and Al Jazeera itself, Al Jazeera's main lie, you see, on this Hisham's case. They stopped him and they captured him and they said, you are not Libyan. He said, but I'm Libyan. And he was talking in Libyan accent. And the people who are in these gangs, some of them are even drug addicts and so on, and criminals released from prison, they were saying, you are not Libyan. Finally, he had a mobile in his telephone, and they took from him, and they called the father while the father is in his work. They said to him, we have captured your son here, and so on, and we are going to kill him, and we cut him into pieces. I said, but why you do that? What? My son is a simple citizen. What he did to you? They said, no. It's not us who killed it. It is the system. He said, why? How? You captured my son. It is not the system. It is in your hand. They said, no. It is you have to mobilize to organize a demonstration against the government. But he said, you are the one who captured my son. Why I have to organize that? And then they stopped, disconnected the discussion, and they called his brother, the younger brother. And the same conversation. So the brother was a bit intelligent. He said, I wanted to speak with my brother. Is it true? He even thought it is a joke. Then he spoke. He said, yes, it's true. And the way they killed him, you can't imagine, that they cut him into pieces. What was the objective? As I have told you, 40% of the Libyan people are black Libyans. Capturing a black Libyan and killing him by another gang, Libyans, who are very primitive or maybe drug addicts or name it that. What was the objective? To create hate, isn't it? So their objective even, it is not to have a normal transition. They wanted to create inter-Libyan contradictions and then create hate among the Libyans, that it is, in fact, preparing for a civil war. Second point, after they captured Masrata. Masrata is a big city. All type of Libyans live there, from wherever region they come. There's government institutions, teachers, name it, doctors, all type, police, soldiers, and so on. Those who took over Masrata, they are from the Masrata area, or the tribe who lives around Masrata. They chased away, and they looted, and raped, and killed those Libyans who are men from Masrata. What was the objective? Who's giving them this direction? It's NATO. The objective is that it is when I am kicked from Masrata and my daughter is raped and my property was taken and my son is killed, when I go back to my area, I mobilize against that tribe. And you break the fabric of the nation building which Libya did for the last 42 years.
I see, to simply create chaos.
To create chaos, yes. That is their major objective. One major military historian, so-called historian, and it is I think he is maybe the most right-wing one, and Ralph Peters is an American colonel. In his book, which is published in the 99, the title is that Fighting for the Future, Will America Triumph? One has to read that book and compare what he's saying and what is happening in Libya.
What was the title of the book?
Fighting for the Future. Will America Trump? Ralph Peters. He takes the Somali experience, the crisis of the American army had with the General Idit. And he explains in details. And he says that all our standard, our ethical value, our weapon must change. We are going to fight in the future in every cities in the third world. If America wants to keep world hegemony. And he explains. And in concrete, how to fight in urban areas, he explained. He have a chapter. And that chapter, when you read, you remember Tripoli, what happened now. There is nothing here, democracy, or it's a fairy tale. It is a colonial invasion. And the only thing is that they will destroy the country as they destroyed Afghanistan and they destroyed Iraq, as they destroyed Somalia. They will destroy Libya, but they will not control it. That is my conclusion.
That was the last thing I wanted to talk to you about. You do not believe that they're going to be able to control Libya internally, do you?
I mean, who's going to work with these people? You must have certain infrastructure. You buy them, buy money, is that so? How? They have break the structure of the police disappeared. This probably people will resist and will fight. Secondly, is it really they are controlling the country? If the other part of the country still is in the hand of the government or on the supporter of the government, or in the hand of the people, the militia and the people thing and so on. how they will rule. They never spoke also about the army. Where is the Libyan army? We have never seen about the Libyan army. It disappeared? It capitulated to the other side? No, of course not.
Well, that's a good question. What did happen to the Libyan army?
The Libyan army controls Misrata, controls all the other things. These people are, in fact, because they didn't succeed to defeat the army, the easiest way that it is to bring gangs and enter into Tripoli and create a panic. That is what Naomi Klan, she says in the book, the shock therapy. And that's what they did when they took over Baghdad capital, and then they brought with them gangs, and they unleashed it on the people, looting and so on, government properties, all and so on, to panic, that the people can be panic and be afraid and remain at home. An American army was only protecting the oil industry. This is a technique. Tripoli is 1,800,000. So once you shock them, then that everything will collapse and we capture. Demoralized will be. Once the head collapses in Tripoli, then the body and the leg and so on in the periphery will collapse. That is the objective was. This is a fairy tale. Eh? Why their theories didn't work in Afghanistan? Their theories in Iraq. Never, United States have never won a war. It toppled the Iraqi government. The only war they have won is that in Grenada. They waged a war against Korea. They didn't win. It was a settlement. In Vietnam, they were defeated. And for that, as a testimony, himself, Robert McNamara, in his book, in retrospective, that is the title of his book. If you read there, he says that American diplomats, CIA, American officers, and so on, in southern Vietnam, they were telling us a fairy tale. They just project their wishes. And what made the United States bankrupt? From being one of the most dynamic economy in the world, now it was almost a bankrupt state. If the United States had succeeded using her military and all in this war, we could have seen it on the contrary. American people are getting poorer and poorer. American industry are dwindling. Certain areas, there is not even electricity. It is going back to third world situation. California could not pay its public servants. Deficit of budget. And what keeps now a little bit United States dollar to survive is that because oil is sold in dollar, because of their puppet regimes in the Gulf and so on, accepted that line. Suppose today Saudi Arabia and the Gulf will decide that we don't sell any more petrol with dollar will collapse and it's finished. Then the hegemony of the United States will disappear.
Well, Mohammed Hassan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Mohammed Hassan. Today's show has been Civil War in Libya. Mohammed Hassan was a diplomat for the country of his birth, Ethiopia, during the 1990s. He has worked in Washington, Beijing, and Brussels. He is co-author of Iraq Under the Occupation and author of a new book, Understanding the Muslim World, forthcoming in late September in French, with an English translation to be published soon after. He is the author of many articles posted at InvestigAction at www.michelcolon.info. That's michelcolon.info. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner and Yara Mako. To leave comments or order copies of shows, email us at blfaulkner@yahoo.com. That's blfaulkner@yahoo.com. Visit our website at gunsandbutter.org.
Something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. Today, we'll hear a great talk by sports commentator Dave Zirin on football and its connection to American culture and why abolishing the game is not the right answer or even the right question. I hope you'll stay tuned. It's early October, and I gather that football season is underway. I gather this from the weekly supermarket circulars, which are hyping stuff for us to consume on what they call game day. Soda pop, chips or Doritos, frozen previously cooked farm-raised shrimp, football-shaped balloons with the name of your favorite team, and our own fresh store-made salsa. That pretty well covers the five basic food groups: salt, sugar, fat, cholesterol, and balloons. See, even if you haven't watched television for the past 20 years, as I haven't, you can still keep up with popular culture. To me, this is late harvest season or late bicycling season. But thanks to Stop and Shop, I understand that for normal Americans, this is early football season. Personally, I like professional sports even less than I like frozen factory-cooked farm-raised shrimp. But I do like the intelligent, socially conscious sports commentary of Dave Zirin. Unlike me, Zirin really likes sports, even professional sports, though he's scathingly critical at the corruption of the system. We'll hear most of a nice public talk Zirin gave just a few weeks ago. It's about football. He tells a fascinating story of the origins of this game. For Zirin, American football is the child of the ruling class and U.S. imperialism and what used to be called muscular Christianity. It's always been violent, always had a very high rate of injuries and fatalities, more or less on purpose, he says. Gotta toughen up those Harvard boys for imperial adventures abroad. From the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli, subjugating the natives is hard work for manly men. Actually, we're still working on Tripoli, which happens to be just down the road from Benghazi, in Libya, of all places. But back to football. Zirin strongly dislikes what pro football does to the players, but he has no sympathy with the progressives who want to ban the game. Zirin's solution? The football field is a workplace. Let's fight for workers. All workers, to regain power to control the nature and conditions of their work. Sounds good to me. It also sounds a bit like socialism, but there you have it. The title of the talk is Violence in Pro Sports. How much is too much? Here is Dave Zirin.
NBC's Sunday Night Football is the number one most watched television show in the United States. The most watched television program in the history of this country was last year's Super Bowl. The second most watched was the Super Bowl the year before that. I mean, and it's so incredible because other sports in this country have actually declined in viewership, the major sports, basketball, baseball, hockey, the traditional big sports. But the NFL just keeps getting bigger and bigger. It's an incredibly influential cultural force, and we should have something to say about why it's so damn popular. It's also a sport that, curiously, is only popular in the United States. And that's very bizarre if you think about it, because other countries, you find people who, you know, love Hollywood movies, for example, or love hip-hop, or love basketball, but they hate the NFL as a point of pride. I mean, I have a buddy from Chile who says to me, he says, "We play football in our country," meaning soccer. "You guys play football imperialismo." Now, why is that? I want to talk about why that is. My second reason for focusing on football is that this question has become a political question. There's a big debate that's broken out among writers, journalists, serious thinkers, and Rush Limbaugh. And the terms of the debate are very simple. Given all we know about head injuries, should this sport be banned? Should there be actually a new prohibition movement or a new boycott movement against football? And I'm going to argue in this talk that both sides of this debate don't know their ass from their elbow. In terms of, so that's going to be part. This is a debate that desperately actually needs to be reframed. So first, to answer the question, why is the sport so popular? The starting point is understanding the social roots of the game, because sports are a reflection of the societies that bring them up. And in our society, football's prominence rose as the United States developed into an industrial and military giant. I mean, after the Civil War, there was a staggering level of growth in this country. I mean, from 1860 to 1900, the population of the U.S. went from 30 to 75 million. New York went from 800,000 to 4 million. Chicago from 100,000 to 2 million. This was the era of booms for the rich and busts for everyone else. It was defined by strikes, instability, class war at home, and a new empire abroad. And the robber barons were obsessed with the idea that their own pampered, privileged children would be completely unprepared to navigate the violent world they'd helped create. And their concern bordered on the hysterical. This is what Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote in the Atlantic Monthly at the end of the 19th century. This is what he was the father of the Supreme Court judge. He said, "I am satisfied that such a set of black-coated, stiff-jointed, soft-muscled, paste-complexioned youth as we can boast in our Atlantic cities never before sprang from the loins of Anglo-Saxon lineage." I don't know if anybody regrets that "sprang from the loins" is no longer used in popular writing anymore. Maybe we'll start a comeback or not. Now, in sports, particularly football, was seen as the answer for these stiff-jointed, soft-muscled children. And a word was actually created for people who didn't like football. That's actually the origin of the word sissy. So the origin of football comes with a lot of the origin of organized homophobia as well, to describe people who did not want to be part of this kind of violent contact. And so the birth of football, people assume because it's such a violent working class sport that it started amongst workers, but it starts at Harvard, Yale, Brown, and they started this form of rugby they called football that really didn't hold much of a relationship to the game today. It actually looked like something out of Braveheart. And you literally had dozens of kids dying every year on football fields at these elite institutions. And one writer put it very well. He said, "U.S. football was born in a morgue," because they created these rules as a way to keep people from dying. And if you step backwards from this, you can actually see why so much of today's sports world is so incredibly twisted. I mean, the heart of the founding of modern athletics, modern football, was economic elites sending their children to die in Ivy League football games because they were terrified they would not be tough enough to lead conquests abroad and industrial brutality at home. And failure to do so made you a sissy. Ladies and gentlemen, the origin of sports in the United States. And this philosophy was proudly known as muscular Christianity. And it can seem like so much macho idiocy. I mean, muscular Christianity. And part of muscular Christianity was, as one writer put it, turning Jesus Christ into a sinewy stud. Like the pictures of Jesus is like buff come out of muscular Christianity. Like, if you ever see things, so like a picture of Christ in your aunt's home or something, and you're just like, wow, Jesus is cut. That comes out of muscular Christianity. This period is when this art was created. And it seems like just macho tomfoolery, but this was about preparing the U.S. for empire. I mean, during this period, the U.S. invades the Philippines, Latin America, the Caribbean, and the values of sport were deeply tied to imperialism and war. And just as these ideas trickled down in society, football trickled down from the Ivy Leagues to being a club sport in large industrial factories. 1919 was the largest year in terms of number of workers who went on strike percentage-wise in the history of the United States. And in the 1920s is when you see football teams start at factories. And people were very explicit. Like, one industrialist said that we're doing this to calm the tensions of our workers. We need to give them creative outlets for their anger other than listening to communist doctrine. You know, all of this stuff you see. And a lot of the NFL teams that we root for now started as factory teams in the 1920s. Like the Chicago Bears, their original name was the Decatur Staleys. And they came out of the Staley plant in Decatur, Illinois. And it's a very short leap to go from muscular Christianity to factory teams to today's militarism at games, with warplanes flying overhead and the very language of sport being so infused with militarism. I mean, I would argue that football has always been about selling a supremely militaristic, twisted, masculine image of the United States back to ourselves. And this works its way into the very language. I mean, the late, great George Carlin said it very well. He said, in football, the object is for the quarterback, otherwise known as the field general, to be on target with his aerial assaults, riddling the defense by hitting his receivers with deadly accuracy in spite of the blitz, even if he has to use the shotgun. With short bullet passes and long bombs, he marches his troops into enemy territory, balancing this aerial assault with a sustained ground attack which punches holes in the forward wall of the enemy's defensive line. Now, this goes right to today. I mean, after all, who tossed the coin at the 2009 Super Bowl? It wasn't John Elway. It wasn't Joe Montana. It was General David Petraeus. And so I understand why people say the NFL is in the business of selling war. But I would argue that the NFL doesn't sell war as much as it's selling a 13-year-old's idea of what war is. Like a highly commercialized, warped vision of masculinity defined by violence, defined by seeing depression as weakness, homosexuality as weakness, and seeking help from other people as weakness. And this is something that's very toxic, but what's interesting about 2012 is that NFL players are actually starting to talk about this. Brandon Marshall, who's a wide receiver in the National Football League, he wrote a remarkable op-ed after Junior Seau committed suicide. And he wrote, in sports, those who show they are hurt or have mental weakness or pain are told, you're not tough, you're not a man. And until last week, what we would hear, you are no Junior Seau. Now, despite all these distortions, the military ties to football and the way the Pentagon just humps the leg of the NFL like a dog in heat, football doesn't really explode in popularity until the 1950s and 60s when television brought it into American homes. And I would argue that you can't understand what makes football so entertaining without understanding what television adds to the experience. And I will say that I find the NFL on its own to be very entertaining as a commercial product. And I watch it, and I don't watch it for the violence, but it's actually when you watch it on television, I find it much less entertaining to be there in person. Because you watch it on television, and it's like every time a quarterback throws a ball, it's off camera. And so it's like, what's going to happen? So every play is like, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? And it's uniquely made for television in that way. They're also, when you have players who can do it really well, like Michael Vick, who can dance between raindrops, or Calvin Johnson, who's known as Megatron, just the coolest nickname ever. I mean, these are players who athletically are thrilling to watch. It also involves strategy, camaraderie, and fun, which in our society can be in short supply. It's understandable why people on Sundays know where they're going to be, and that's on the couch watching an NFL game. And for those who dismissively call this the opiate of the masses, I would say, and your problem with opium is what? I mean, and I think what's difficult is that we need to reconcile the fact that football can be very entertaining and also reflect a value system informed by empire. It's warped by contradiction, but so much of culture under capitalism is warped by contradiction. Think about the music industry, which can mass produce both amazing music, but can also be just an engine of sexism or racism or homophobia. Or just think about what I think about a lot, which is like the perfect bowl of spaghetti and meatballs. I mean, it can be a work of art when done. Alex in the third row makes a beautiful bowl of macaroni and gravy. And it's like that I said that? That was almost Italian. Thank you. Thank you, Alex. And it's like the tomatoes that you're eating have been picked under evil conditions. The cows that went into these meatballs are probably pumped full of hormones and produced in a kind of conditions that would absolutely horrify you if you actually had to see the slaughterhouse. That's capitalism. Or the fact that my daughter loves Taylor Swift. I mean, Taylor Swift, I wish she loved Taylor Branch, but it's Taylor Swift. I mean, Taylor Swift writes her own music, plays her own music. She sings songs about, you know, girl power and whatnot. But Taylor Swift is also a blonde Cupid doll, and she weighs like 8 pounds. I mean, this doesn't mean you don't challenge these contradictions. You shout them from the highest hills. Like I say to my daughter, Sasha, Taylor Swift needs a snack. And that's okay. And the contradictions in the NFL are exploding. I mean, players, because there's been this whole discussion's exploded about concussions and head injuries, players are more outspoken. The union is more outspoken. 2,000 players suing are fighting back, trying to change the culture of the sport. Their pain and their struggle have sparked a debate happening right now about the place and role of football in our lives, whether our kids should play, and whether we are watching something that deserves to be boycotted or even banned. And to be clear, this is a very good thing that this debate is happening. It's already forced the NFL to change some of their practices. I mean, this is a league that as recently as 2009 employed as their chief neurologist someone who was not a neurologist. As recently as 2009, their chief neurologist was a rheumatologist. And this rheumatologist sat in front of the U.S. Congress and said that he did not believe there was a proven connection between playing football and brain injuries. Seriously. This isn't 1809. This is 2009. And this debate has also emboldened the players' union in the last contracts to win unprecedented demands, limiting practices, limiting contact, improving helmets, winning the right to buy into their health care plan for life. Before the last collective bargaining agreement, every NFL player was actually kicked off their health care 5 years after retirement, no matter how long they played. And if you think about the pre-existing conditions, they wouldn't be able to get health care after that. No one would insure them. Now they can buy in for life. I mean, I knew a player whose wife got a job at UPS after 5 years because his medical, even though he made millions of dollars, they quickly went away in medical bills. They were bankrupt by the time he was 50 years old. His wife had to work at UPS so he would be covered medically so he could keep going to the doctor. That was the reality for far too many families. And it's also emboldened the union to stand up to efforts in the league to have an 18-game season, which is longer, or the sham bounty investigation of the Saints, which is pure, unadulterated bullshit, which is not about player safety at all, but about the NFL covering its own. People have questions about it. We can talk about it. And it's making parents reassess if they want their kids doing this. I mean, there's a sea change of thought taking place. Think about what I said about football being so popular in this country. 1 million less kids were signed up for youth football this year than a year ago. And it's changed people's thinking. My father-in-law was drafted by the Dallas Cowboys. And he's gone in just the last year from saying that my son, who's 4, needs to play tackle football, to saying maybe we should keep Jake off the field. Or forget my father-in-law, Kurt Warner, for goodness sakes. A little more prestige than my father-in-law. He is a Super Bowl-winning quarterback. He said he doesn't want his kids playing football, and this is a good thing as well. We should be having this debate, but unfortunately, the terms of the debate are awful, and this really shouldn't surprise us, because in this country, on its best day, official political debate is just awful. I mean, as Bart Simpson said, it manages to both and... I mean, think about debates about the things that actually matter in our society, like health care, racism, war, the prison system. I mean, it's insufferable when you hear what are supposed to be the two sides debating this. And I would argue that the debate about football is no different, and all the more reason why it needs to be reframed. I mean, on the right, you have people like Rush Limbaugh saying that any effort to regulate football and apply the neurological science that we're learning is about a socialist, commie, feminazi plot to end freedom. And this is a quote from Rush Limbaugh on his own show. And I quote, "It's not going to be long before the wusses, the new castrati in our society, are going to suggest that football be banned, that tackle football be banned." At the risk of sounding violent, I'd love for Rush Limbaugh to exercise his freedom to play tackle football and meet a man named Ray Lewis. Now, Limbaugh also said, his voice dripping with contempt, or maybe OxyContin, hard to tell, he said, "What's going to happen is somebody's going to figure out here pretty soon that since 75% of the players in the NFL are African American, that 75% of the concussions are being suffered by African Americans, 75% of the heart attacks, early deaths, whatever." And then he just sort of trailed off. I told you, it was dripping with something. Now, two things about what Rush said. The first is that the number of African Americans in the NFL is 70%, but who needs facts when you are Rush Limbaugh? Second, I mean, does institutional racism as well as poverty play a role in why African Americans are 70% of NFL players? Of course it does. I mean, I asked a coach in Gulfport, Mississippi, why so many football players were African-American, and he said, "When you have poverty, racism, and year-round sunshine, you have the perfect soil to grow pro athletes." But one thing Limbaugh is poking at that's actually true is that the view by a lot of people who are making the banning argument is that players somehow need to be saved from us or from themselves, from the bloodthirsty mob. And I do want to say that being an NFL fan does not make you part of a bloodthirsty mob, unless you're a fan of the Philadelphia Eagles. It just doesn't do that. Sorry. Okay. Put that in there last second. I was like, that'll be funny. It wasn't. Now, The most prominent spokesperson for the banned football argument is a writer by the name of Malcolm Gladwell. Malcolm Gladwell is the celebrity author of bestsellers like The Tipping Point and Blink, The Power of Thinking Without Thinking, and other books that are like explaining the world through the miracle that is ketchup. Gladwell is the most prominent public intellectual arguing this. And his argument is that football is like dogfighting, another barbaric sport that was once legal, but which we have evolved as a society and now look down upon and criminalize. He implies that players are like the dogs, good people bred to be violent, who need to be saved. And as he wrote in The New Yorker, he said, "In a fighting dog, the quality that is prized above all others is the willingness to persevere, even in the face of injury and pain. A dog that keeps charging at its opponent is said to possess gameness, and game dogs are revered. Professional football players, too, are selected for gameness." Now, I would argue that this argument is condescending and reeks of class arrogance as well as racism. I'm sorry, but comparing people to dogs is absolutely obnoxious. Athletes are workers. They happen to work in a profoundly unsafe workplace, but they are workers. And honestly, to those who make the Hunger Games argument, I would say that if you want to organize against unsafe workplaces where people die because of unsafe conditions, there are many more productive places to turn than the National Football League. I mean, the U.S. has the most unsafe workplaces in the industrialized world. And more U.S. workers died on the job in 2011 than U.S. soldiers have died in Afghanistan and Iraq since 9/11. So a little bit of perspective, please. And then there's the argument on the prohibition side that's more abstract. It says, we live in a culture of militarism and violence, and banning the NFL is about taking on this culture of violence that surrounds us all. I mean, the idea that somehow if we ban the NFL, we are somehow confronting this culture of violence is ludicrous. I mean, this country is not violent because of the NFL. It's violent because we live in the heart of a global empire that thinks nothing of slaughtering hundreds of thousands of people in Iraq and Afghanistan or sending unmanned drones to kill entire families who get in the crossfire of presidential kill lists. I mean, we live in a country that thinks nothing of jailing 2 million of its own citizens. And if you want to confront this culture of violence, I would suggest that you start there. Now, I think the best approach, and I alluded to this before, is like to see pro football as a profoundly unsafe workplace. That's what it is. It's not a plantation. It's not dogfighting. Players aren't dogs. We should support the players' union's demands that players have the best health care and as few practices as possible. We should expose the lies of NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell and owners that he is somehow concerned about the health and well-being of NFL players. We should raise our voices and challenge what we don't like about football to change. And the idea of fans organizing actually has a rich history that goes back 100 years, and there's no reason not to revive it. Now, Eugene Debs, by the way, socialist leader, turn of the century, for those who don't know who that is. Got 1 million votes in prison in 1920, amazing orator, amazing speaker. Debs also was somebody who hated booze. He said he wanted to fight for a world where people didn't feel the need to drink, which is not necessarily what I'm fighting for. But his position on prohibition, I think, is a model for us today when we talk about this. It's hard to find this stuff. My dear comrade Scott McLemy, who's the one to go to, he found this letter that Eugene Debs wrote to the head of the prohibition movement about why neither he nor the Socialist Party would be a part of the prohibition movement. This is what Debs wrote. He wrote, "I admit all you say about the liquor evil, and we differ only in the way this evil will be destroyed. Prohibition will never do it. There is but one way to get at the evil, and that is by abolishing the profit system, at which intemperance is the legitimate fruit. Socialists are right in refusing to be led away from the main issue and to give attention to the thousand and more ills that flow from capitalism, private ownership, profit, and exploitation. For reasons of my own, I am opposed to the principle of prohibition. Theft and murder are prohibited, but it is to be doubted if these crimes are lessened by any appreciable extent on that account. The world pays too much attention to the effects while it ignores causes, and this is as true of the liquor evil as it is of any of the evils that afflict society." I mean, and he's right, of course. What does prohibition do? All it does is drive a practice underground, and when it's driven underground, it makes it less safe. Randy here is from Texas, and one could imagine a world of speakeasies underground where little kids are playing tackle football against each other, completely unregulated, and you need a secret knock just to get in to the Dallas basement to watch 7-year-olds knock each other silly. I don't know if that's an ignorant view of Texas, but... No, that sounds right. And in contrast, 5 minutes. Good. In contrast, Pop Warner, which is the big league for youth sports, this week, it was fortunate with doing this talk, in response to the science, said that they were going to have now full-scale regulation, eliminate contact and practices, et cetera, to try to eliminate the kind of subconcussive hits as much as possible. I mean, once again, it's a safer cigarette, but it's a step in the right direction. And I think we need to fight for more knowledge on this, on its own. And we need to know more about the neurology. We need to have neurologists who aren't paid for by the National Football League or the U.S. Armed Forces. Those are the two leading engines of money for people finding out what are the real effects of concussions. People who treat what's called TBI in the Army, traumatic brain injury, and people in the National Football League. And obviously, I mean, call me crazy, but I think this kind of science is highly biased against seeing people actually get treated for their injuries. So this leads to just the last question here. If football is so popular, and this is a question you know you get in a lot, usually at a bar, would it exist in a socialist society? And I know some people are like, oh, geez, that question. But I would make this case here. I mean, football is so much a part of the American fabric. When this fabric is eventually torn asunder, will people still want to play? I think that's the starting point. And the answer is maybe. Maybe they will. Maybe they won't. That's going to be up for the people who create this society to decide. But I can guarantee that the sports we play, whether football or not, will be more humane. I can guarantee that no one will play because they feel like it's their best shot out of poverty. And I guarantee that the sports we play will reflect a world where freedom is not warped to mean the freedom to inflict pain or hurt other people in the hopes of making money. And if there is a form of football, it won't be a sport that reflects the values of empire. And that brings us back to Junior Seau and this mystery of why he took his own life. And I'll end with this. I mean, I'd be negligent in talking about Seau's suicide if I didn't point out that he is Samoan. And Samoan men have the highest suicide rates on earth. I don't know if people knew that. And I interviewed a Samoan journalist about why that was after Seau's suicide. Why do Samoan men have the highest suicide rate on the planet? And he said to me, he was very upset. He knew the Seau family. And he said, it's what happens when you colonize and humiliate a warrior people. And he said, it happens when you colonize and humiliate a warrior people. I think about that you a lot, because the you is the United States. The you is its agenda, its values, and its concept of freedom, which means more and more the freedom to work and the freedom to die. And any country that exists on a foundation of exploitation and empire needs to be challenged in our culture, in our workplaces, in our locker room, and in the streets. Because as Frederick Douglass said, you know, this is a country that would shame a nation of savages. And that's not about football. That's about everything from the rooter to the tutor. And it's why we need to stand up strong and powerful and challenge this no matter where it rears its head. So thank you very much.
Dave Zirin, with a view of football somewhat different from what you'll find on Wide World of Sports. I condensed Zirin's talk a little to fit our time slot. You'll find a link to the uncut version on our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Zirin spoke at the Socialism 2012 conference in September, and I speak from the East of the River Satellite Studios and Skunk Works of WWUHFM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. Thank you for listening. Illicit to my non-carborundum, and if I don't drop the ball, talk to you again next week. Ciao.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
Listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. On the 15th anniversary of 9/11, the Justice in Focus Symposium took place at Cooper Union in New York City. The focus of the conference was to look at what legal avenues could be pursued to get 9/11 truth in the courts, to present the mountains of evidence that prove that the official account of what happened on 9/11 is totally false and fraudulent. Today you'll hear attorney Daniel Sheehan of Karen Silkwood fame discussing this issue and what we're up against. So let's begin.
I point out at the beginning of this legal discussion that I'm not here today to support or defend or to attempt to criticize any particular of the alternative legal theories that might be available. You've heard a few discussed here today, just recently with the panel, the discussion of whether or not the United States government officials in the FBI and the CIA and the other agencies that have been involved were simply incompetent, or whether or not they may have been more involved in some type of scienter or evil intent in actually being involved in setting up some of these Saudi dupes has been talked about before. And you just keep in mind that there's the old adage in law that the people who are responsible for something like this would much rather be considered to be a fool than a knave. That seems to be the nature of the debate partly going on now about what particular types of alternative theories may develop out of the evidence. But what I want to do this afternoon, I want to be able to direct our attention to a number of important legal principles, because one of the things that's going to be being proposed this weekend by the people who've been working at this for 15 years is that a specific law firm be set up, or a legal team be set up, to pursue the investigation, the expert evidence, the evaluation of the legal theories, etc., to be the base of an operation to try to see whether or not such an additional, supplemental, or parallel legal case is going to be viable. And what I want to be able to do as sort of a senior, not so much senior statesman as a senior class member of the baby boom generation who's been trying these types of cases for going on 50 years now, as it turns out, that I've been engaged in prosecuting and defending political cases, dozens of them over this 50-year period, these politically charged cases. And what I want to do is I want to set forth what might be considered sort of the Ten Commandments that people who are going to be considered to be part of this legal team need to keep in mind, and that you as potential laypersons who are participating and supporting this type of an endeavor need to keep this in mind, so that you will see as the legal team, if one is developed, what the principles are that they're following, that you'll understand and appreciate them. One of them has been touched upon a number of times, and what I'll do is I'll be careful not to wander off into too many war stories, but I will share a few of them with you to dramatize some of the principles that we need to observe. One of these principles has been that whoever is being involved in supporting the legal team and who are working on the legal team, they have to be ready to be aggressively criticized by the mainstream media. Not just ridiculed lightly, but aggressively attacked. And I'll give you one particular example. In the Iran-Contra case, we at the Christic Institute had filed the Iran-Contra case back in May of 1986. And there was a dead silence about this. We talked to everybody about it. We talked to people at the New York Times. We talked to people in NBC News. We talked to PBS. We talked to people in Congress about it. There was dead silence on this until October 5th of 1986, when Eugene Hasenfuss was shot down by the Nicaraguan Sandinista government over Nicaragua in a C-123 flying weapons into the Contras in complete violation of the Boland Amendment that had been passed by Congress. And all that news hit the stands, and right away we were called, finally. People kept saying, listen, isn't that the thing the Christic Institute's been trying to tell everybody about? And so what happened is that the journalist community, actually, who had said nothing about this, gathered together at the New School for Social Research here in New York City, or at the Avenue of the Americas in West 12th Street. And they filled up a place the size of this with professional credentialed journalists in the room. And I remember that Leslie Coburn from CBS had undertaken to try to do a piece for West 57th Street on this. And I got up and I presented to the entire room of some maybe 300 credentialed journalists what we were saying at the Christic Institute about what was really going on behind the whole Iran-Contra crisis. That this wasn't some young individual renegade lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps that had somehow gone around and recruited old retired military experts off the golf courses, you know, outside of Washington, D.C., and happened to slap together this, you know, slapdash weapons supply operation. This was a high-level coordinated criminal conspiracy on the part of high-level government officials in the CIA and in the White House, being run directly out of George H.W. Bush's vice presidential office, and that his vice presidential national security advisor, Donald P. Gregg, was helping to coordinate this whole thing, and that he was the CIA case officer for Felix Rodriguez, who was running the Ilopango airlift out of Central America, and we've been telling everybody this. And so when we got done making this presentation, people's jaws were kind of hanging open in the room, and somebody stood up and they said, Leslie Coburn from CBS, do you believe that what the Christic Institute is saying is true? And she got up and she said, look, I'm just speaking for myself now, not CBS, but I can tell you I've looked into this and I believe that it's true. And there was this whole rumble went around in the room, and one of the journalists stood up and they said to Warren Hogue, who was the foreign desk editor of the New York Times, who was standing there on the forum with us, and they said, Warren, why hasn't the New York Times printed anything about this? And he said, gee, I don't know. And so one of the other people in the audience stood up, now made bold, stands up and says, look, would you give us your promise that you'll send somebody down to the Christic Institute to gather this information? And he said, uncomfortably, he said, okay, I'll do that. And the next week, he sends down a young fellow, like 26 years old, who was in fact a reporter for the agricultural section of the New York Times. And this fellow didn't even know who the FDN Contras were. So I explained the whole thing to him. I gave him all of the details of this, and I could see him writing like mad. He could see Pulitzer Prizes, you know, dancing in his head. So I give him the whole thing, and he goes back to New York, and 2 days pass, 3 days pass, 4 days pass, a week passes. I give him a call, and I say, Neil, what's the story? You know, you said you were going to do a story. He says, well, look, I got to come back down and talk to you. He comes back down to talk to me. And he says, look, I got a problem here. My editors at the New York Times tell me that you're giving us information that's hearsay information, that you weren't there to see them unloading the cocaine. You weren't there to see them loading the weapons. You didn't see the weapons being handled. I said, okay, first party witnesses. So I took him around and I introduced him to pilots that were flying the weapons in. We showed him the false end user certificates. We showed him the serial numbers on the weapons that were being smuggled. We talked to the pilots. We brought him in. They showed him the landing codes to land on John Hull's ranch. They gave him the secret code words you had to use to land on the ranch. So he says, oh, this is it. Pulitzer, here I come. And so he goes back to New York, and I don't hear anything. 2, 3, 4, 5 days, 6 days, 7 days. I call him again. I say, Neil, what's the story? And what aren't you doing? He says, look, I got to come down and talk to you again. He comes back down. He tells me, he says, look, here's my problem. My editors keep telling me that if I'm going to write anything about this story, it has to be negative. It has to be negative about your investigation. It's got to be negative about what your assertions are that are being made here, or else I can't write anything. I was kind of dumbfounded by that whole thing. So I said, look, let me tell you an additional story and see if this will get you there. And I told him that after we'd done our preliminary investigation and prepared all the Iran-Contra case, and prior to our filing the RICO complaint, I had taken all the information over to see Scott Armstrong. Scott Armstrong was the head of the National Security Archives in Washington, D.C. He had been one of the chief investigators for Peter Rodino on the House Judiciary Committee investigating the Watergate burglary. That's how I knew him. Because, you know, I was at F. Lee Bailey's office. We represented James McCord, the wiretap specialist in the break-in. And he's the guy that blew the whistle on Richard Nixon. Wrote the letter to Judge Sirica blowing the whistle on the plumbers and all that. So I knew Scott. So I go and I sit down with him and I give him all this information. And Scott says, "This can't be true. This can't be true what you're saying. If this were true, I'd know it." I said, "Well, actually, it is true, and you apparently don't know it. And so I think you should spend a few days checking up your sources and see what you think." He calls me back 3 days later. He says, "Danny, come on over. Come on. You got to come over." So I went over to the National Security Archives. He sits down. He said, "My God," he said, "this is true. I talked to Cy Hirsch, and I talked to some other guys. They've all confirmed this." He said, "Look, here's what I'm going to do." He says, "I'm going to go over to see Peter Rodino. He's still the chair of the House Judiciary Committee. They have the authority and the responsibility for bringing up articles of impeachment. And this stuff here that you're saying, these are impeachable offenses, not only against Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, Donald Gregg, Bill Casey, the head of the CIA, Ed Meese, and his other people." He said, "This is tremendous. I'm going to go over and talk to him right away. I'll call you back in a couple of days. I'm going to get him to set up a special select committee inside the House of Representatives and the Judiciary Committee, and he'll have me chair that. You know, he loves me," he said, "because I was actually the one that got Alexander Butterworth to tell about the secret taping system inside Nixon's office." He said, "So that's what really broke the whole Watergate case in the impeachment of Nixon and everything else. So he'll make me the chief of staff for that committee." So I said, "Great." So I leave, and 2 days pass, 3 days pass, 4 days pass, 5 days pass. I don't hear a word. So I call up over there, and I get a hold of Tom Blanton, his assistant. I say, "Tommy, what's the matter? I haven't heard from you." He says, "Danny, you got to come on over." So I go back over, and I sit down with Blanton. Blanton's got his head hanging down. He says, "Danny," he says, "Scott went over and talked to Peter Rodino, brought a copy of your complaint," and he gave it to him. Rodino sat there and looked through the whole thing, and Rodino, he turned to Scott, and he said, "Scott, this is terrible. This is outrageous." He said, "Well, if what's being said here in this complaint is true, why then I've been telling my constituents for years that if they didn't like the way that American foreign policy was going, they ought to write a letter to their congressman. And if the congressman doesn't do anything, you ought to elect somebody else. Put another congressman in there. But if what's being said in this complaint is true, why then we haven't even been in charge. I'm not going to allow the United States Congress to investigate anything like that," is what he said to him. So I tell this story to Neil, this agricultural reporter from the New York Times. And he goes back, and the New York Times writes its first story about the Christie Institute lawsuit, saying Dan Sheehan is running around Washington, D.C. irresponsibly telling third-hand stories about aging congressmen. And that's all it said. You know, it didn't say who was the aging congressman, what was he told, you know, what was his response. You know, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, they're basically representing the chairman of the Judiciary Committee as an incompetent mentis, you know, who you shouldn't even say anything to the newspaper about. So that this is the kind of thing that you can expect if you really start moving on this type of a politically charged case. You're also going to be attacked not only from the right, which is totally to be expected, because they've drunk the Kool-Aid by the gallon that has been fed to them by the 9/11 Commission, but you're also going to be attacked by the sort of harder core left, because they're going to try to want you to file the lawsuit against the Central Intelligence Agency. And you ought to be filing the lawsuit against W. Bush. He's still alive. So is Cheney. Cheney's got a whole new heart. We may have him around for years. So we want you to sue him. And we want you to sue the CIA as an organization. They don't have any kind of understanding, many of the people, about what the legal restrictions are on what you can actually do through the legal system and through the court system, primarily because the court system has not been set up to do cases like this. The court system is set up by the financiers who set up the original federal government, Alexander Hamilton and the other financial geniuses that wanted to have a centralized economic system and weights and measures and stuff for the colonies. And the fact of the matter is they're not set up to actually challenge the government itself, except that they've always known there's a risk, so they've set up the immunity statute. And it's not the foreign immunity statute that's just been set up as a restriction on, a caveat on by JASTA. But in fact, they have a general principle of sovereign immunity that no matter what kind of accusations you make about the government itself and officials inside the United States government, you cannot sue them unless they agree to it. So they have to agree to allow you to sue them. Or you can sue them under the Federal Tort Claims Act. They've waived certain immunities with regard to regular common law garden variety tort claims. Like if a U.S. postal driver runs over some poor person in the street, you can sue them under the normal common law theories in their capacity under the Federal Tort Claims Act. But you don't get any jury. You can't have a jury. You've got to try the case to a federal judge who has been appointed by the president of the executive branch. And you not only don't get any jury, you don't get any punitive damages. All you can get is your actual hospital bills or out-of-pocket costs. There are all kinds of restrictions they've placed on even the Tort Claims Act. So the bottom line is that you need to understand you're going to be getting aggressive criticism from the extreme left. We're going to be criticizing you for not suing the CIA and charging them with being running lapdogs of the capitalist class. So you have to be prepared for that. Now, you always also have to remember that the judges, any court that you're going to file this case in, state court or federal court, you've got to remember, all of these judges are selected or appointed politically. You know, they're appointed by the executive branch. They are always appointed by a member of the executive branch who just happens to be the same political party that the judge is from, and that the judge has always been in that political party, has been an apparat in the political party prior to their being appointed. That's how they got there. And so that virtually all of the decisions that they make are political. Now, that isn't pertinent in every case, like, you know, a dog bites man case or a domestic violence case particularly. But the bottom line is, as soon as you start to have a case that has substantial political implications, they're going to be making political decisions. And you get a whole bunch of these that, for example, in the Karen Silkwood case that we did out in Oklahoma, we end up asking for discovery in the Silkwood case against the Kerr-McGee Nuclear Corporation. And it turns out that the first judge that we got, Luther Bohannon, absolutely refused to give us any discovery. We'd file subpoenas for documents. The Kerr-McGee Corporation would ignore them. We'd file subpoenas to have them come to take depositions. They wouldn't bother coming. We'd file motions to compel. And Luther Bohannon just completely ignored them, never ruled on them, wouldn't do anything. We finally started going after him in the newspapers and saying that he was sitting on these motions to compel. He wouldn't do anything. And so he finally orders a hearing, and we have a public hearing. He wanted to have it in chambers. We insisted upon having it out in open court. We come into the open court, and he starts raging at me, saying that you're a magpie running off at both ends, as he actually put it. And he started sort of slobbering on himself and getting crazy. And so that what we did is we filed a motion to have him recused. And he got recused by the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. We got a second judge, Luther Eubanks, came in. Luther Eubanks was totally incompetent. I think I can say this now, only because everybody knows it. And we were taking a deposition of Jackie Cerugi, who was a woman who was writing a book about Karen Silkwood. She came to the Congress and tried to get them to stop having any investigation about what happened to Karen Silkwood when she was killed on the highway on the way to meet with David Burnham from the New York Times to deliver a whole set of internal documents from the Kerr-McGee Corporation that showed that they were missing over 40 pounds of 98% pure bomb-grade plutonium from the facility. And she thought that it just meant that they were messy. As it turns out, what she had stumbled upon, the MUF documents, the missing and unaccounted-for records, is that the 40 pounds of bomb-grade plutonium was actually being smuggled to Israel by the American Central Intelligence Agency and the high-level officials of the Kerr-McGee Nuclear Corporation, because the Kerr-McGee, the Kerr of that, was Robert S. Kerr, who was the chairman of the Senate, the Military Appropriations Committee. And so the entire operation was a covert operation to smuggle the plutonium to Israel, and they had to share that plutonium. Israel had to share the plutonium with Iran under the Shah. And then they had to share it with the Afrikaner government down in South Africa. And that we had exposed this. And the minute that we exposed this, by this time we were working on our third judge. We had a third federal judge brought in by the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. And so we filed that information with him. And the minute that we filed that information with him, he called a special meeting saying that, look, the CIA has contacted me, and they're sending people out to see me on Monday morning. I wasn't supposed to tell you about this. They wanted an in-camera secret hearing with me to file a motion to dismiss the case, but I thought I had to tell you about it, so I want you here Monday morning. So I come into the court Monday morning, and there's Judge Frank G. Tice. He's up on the bench. He says, I'm glad to see you here this morning, Mr. Sheehan. He said, I've told you I'm going to have this meeting with the CIA people, and I know you don't agree with this. I know you're going to object. I'll put it on the record. But I've decided I'm going to have the meeting. You can't come into the meeting.
And just then, Glenn Whitaker, the attorney for the FBI and the Justice Department, comes walking through the door with these three suits from the CIA, and they come walking in, and the judge goes into chambers with them, right? And then Cy Hirsch, the investigative reporter from the New York Times, comes rushing in the door of the courtroom. This is the Oklahoma Federal Courtroom, the courthouse that was later bombed in Oklahoma. They were in the courthouse, and in he comes, and he says, "Dan, what's going on? What's going on? I just got a word from my CIA sources that they're out here on the Silkwood case. What's happening?" So I explained the whole thing to him, all about the plutonium being smuggled to Israel, all the details, all the evidence we had about it. He said, "Oh," he said, "gee, they're never going to let you get at that." He says, "That's like trying to find out who really killed Kennedy." I mean, this is the chief investigative reporter for the New York Times. And not only that, he didn't print a word about it, you know, about what was happening in the Silkwood case. And then Judge Tice comes out on the bench after 15 minutes. And he gets up on the bench and he says, "Well, Mr. Sheehan, you can be on the record." He says this. He says, "Well, Mr. Sheehan, you can be certain that it's sinister," he says, "but it's also most definitely secret." He says, "This is just a glass mountain that you're not going to be allowed to climb in this case. So I am taking judicial notice at this moment that you filed your count one in this case under the Federal Civil Rights Act, charging that Ms. Silkwood had had her First Amendment rights to meet with the New York Times violated. She'd had her First Amendment rights to travel freely on the highway safely interfered with. And she'd had her home invaded, a violation of the Fourth Amendment right of privacy, planting 400 disintegrations per minute of radioactive plutonium on the food in the refrigerator in her house. You've laid out these claims that are a violation of her Civil Rights Act. But I want to take judicial notice here that the Federal Civil Rights Act was passed in 1868, immediately following the end of the Civil War. And I'm taking judicial notice of the fact that the Civil War was fought solely for the purpose of freeing the black race from slavery. And therefore, the Federal Civil Rights Act applies only to black people. And since you've not alleged anywhere within the four corners of your complaint that Ms. Silkwood was a member of the Negro race, I'm going to be summarily dismissing this count from the complaint. Dismiss the entire count on her house being contaminated, the part about running off the highway, being killed, her body disappearing for 48 hours, nobody being able to know where her body was. They finally found it 48 hours later in the morgue at the Oklahoma City Hospital, a Jane Doe tag on her toe, with all of her internal organs completely missing. Okay? And that was not justiciable. That was not justiciable because that was under the Federal Civil Rights Act and we hadn't claimed that she was a member of the Negro race. What I'm trying to say to you here is that to the attorneys that are going to be working on this case, you need to be prepared to understand that the judge in the case that you're going to be doing is not going to be your friend, that you're going to have another lawyer in the courtroom at all times who is there litigating against you. And so you're going to have to be prepared to do that. So you're going to have to understand also that they are not going to give you access to the federal rules of civil discovery just because the law says they have to. And that's what the entire rules of federal civil procedure were about, that were crafted. The chair of that whole committee was David Shapiro, who happened to be my professor at Harvard Law School on civil procedure, so I'm quite familiar with them all. But the fact of the matter is they will not let you get at those rules of civil procedure. They will block you. They will resist you. They will ignore your motions to compel. So the fact of the matter is you're going to have a major mass-based movement behind what you're trying to do. And you're going to have a full-time coordinator of the media who's going to be reaching out and putting the stories on the internet, putting the stories into all of the alternative media, going to try to get the major news media to report these things. You have to have a full-scale operation going. And you need to have a field organizer, a grassroots organizer that organizes out around the country and organizes task force and teams in virtually every congressional district in the country.
And again, you were just listening to attorney Daniel Sheehan speaking at the 9/11 symposium called Justice in Focus that took place on September 11th, 2016 in New York City. Tune in next week to hear the conclusion of that speech. Since World Trade Center Building 7, the third tower to explode and collapse on 9/11, and which wasn't hit by a plane, is one of the most obvious challenges to the official story of 9/11, I thought I'd end the show today with a song about it. If the evidence gathered by the 9/11 truth movement could ever be presented in a court of law, I believe the whole government and media cover-up of 9/11 would be blown to bits. So here's local musician Carl Seeger Henry with Mark Saunders and Gary Fox sharing their great song, Building 7, The Smoking Gun.
Building 7, The Smoking Gun. It tells the truth about what was done to me and you and to the world. It tells the truth. It tells the truth. 9/11, Building 7. Oh, 9/11, Building 7. At the World Trade Center, three buildings came down, hit by two planes, panic all around. But Building 7 had barely a scratch, not hit by a plane, yet it still collapsed. And office fires were blamed for that. Building 7, the smoking gun. It tells the truth about what was done to me and you and to the world. It tells the truth. It tells the truth. 9/11, Building 7. Oh, 9/11, Building 7. The first responders saw molten steel. They heard explosions, for they were real. And we all watched a scene surreal. Those buildings fell with roaring blast. A demolition, controlled and fast. Building 7, the smoking gun. It tells the truth about what was done to me and you and to the world. It tells the truth. It tells the truth. 9/11, Building 7. Oh, 9/11, Building 7. We want the truth. The real cause. So many questions, it gives one pause. The official story, so full of flaws. Our leaders command us to just move on. We're here to tell you we won't move on. We're here to tell you we won't move on. We're here to tell you we won't move on. 'Cause Building 7's the smoking gun. We see the truth about what was done to me and you and to the world. It tells the truth. It tells the truth. 9/11, Building 7. Oh, 9/11, Building 7. Oh, 9/11, Building 7. 9/11, Building 7.
This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Prisons can't run without inmates. In more ways than one, prisoners, they wash floors and they work in the laundries and kitchens and provide a large amount of the labor that keeps their facilities running. In return, they earn pennies per hour or even no pay at all. That's sparking what may have been the largest prison strike yet as inmates across the country stopped working on September 9th.
The strikers are calling for an end to forced labor and what they call prison slavery. And it's no coincidence that they picked September 9th as the strike date. It was the 45th anniversary of the Attica Rebellion, when prisoners at the Attica Correctional Facility in New York demanded their rights in one of the most significant civil rights occurrences of the century.
Now, we're joined by Cole Dorsey and Michael Forrest with the Incarcerated Workers Organization. And Michael is also with the Black Rose Anarchist Federation. And we've been joined unexpectedly but delightedly by Cindy, who's also working with the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee. And they're part of Industrial Workers of the World, and they're here to discuss the September 9th prison labor strike and some of the things that have been happening around so-called gang raids in New York. Now, Cole Dorsey, first of all, welcome. And I feel like we've got both coasts in the house, which is really a good thing. I recently reread a letter that said, and I quote, "I'm beginning to believe that the USA stands for the underprivileged slaves of America." That was written by a 20th century prisoner from Mississippi in a letter detailing the daily violence he witnessed behind prison walls. His statement resounds with a long tradition of prisoners, particularly African American prisoners, who have used the language and narrative of slavery to describe the conditions of their imprisonment. And I wonder if you can talk to that and how that ties in with the September 9th strike. And again, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. Yeah, I think the important part is the real organizers of this call, Free Alabama Movement and other prison organizers. The important part that they like to distinguish is that the 13th Amendment did not outlaw slavery. To quote it, it says, "Abolish slavery, involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime." So I like to listen to a lot to what Melvin Ray and some of the other founders of FAM have to say on the subject. They wrote a good piece called "Let the Crops Rot in the Plantation Fields." And one of the points they bring up is Angola, for example, how what was once a slave plantation never stopped production, the 13th Amendment. It just changed from private ownership into state ownership. So taking the profits from agriculture in the South, instead they made it prisoners as opposed to calling them slaves. A lot were caught by slave catchers or freed slaves, quote-unquote, were caught and put on trumped-up charges, put right back into the same institutions or same plantations that they had just thought that they had escaped. So it literally is. And then now we have, you know, there's like four states that don't pay at all, Texas, Colorado, a couple others that don't pay workers anything. And it's one thing, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you're doing work to keep something running, you should be compensated for it, just like anyone else on the outside. But the problem is that we don't only have prisoners running the facility. We have them now sewing for Victoria's Secret or packaging meat for McDonald's. So you have these major corporations not paying payroll taxes, not paying unemployment insurance, but getting that benefit of this 2.4 million labor force that is forced to languish in these prisons in the United States. So there really is a direct connection, and especially when we relate it to race and the fact of sentencing and how it more greatly affects people of color, poor people, poor working class people, people with mental illness, substance abuse issues. These are the people that are marginalized. These are the people that are cast out by society and considered expendable. So the state then, instead of deciding social welfare programs or trying to assist them or offering these types of jobs on the outside at prevailing or union wages, will incarcerate you at a mass level and force you to work or not get out. You know, a lot of parole is dependent on having a job. So what we see is that it's really become, the state has used it to their advantage with these private corporations and to perpetuate the same system of institutional racism and white supremacy that we had prior to the 13th Amendment.
And I don't know if our folks from up north want to address anything that their brother Cole Dorsey has said. Cindy,
I really appreciate what Cole laid out, and I would just add that in New York State specifically, a lot of people think that there is no private production in prisons, but there actually is. There's over a dozen facilities in New York that do what's called industry work, and the history of that is actually that a lot of that work is for state goods, so like the trash cans in New York City are made in prison. The benches, actually, that you sit in court before you go to prison.
That's pretty ironic.
Yeah, are made by prisoners. It's really sick, actually. And the desks in a lot of schools are made by prisoners. There's a lot more commodities, too. And
so there are more desks made by prisoners than there are people who are incarcerated that actually get to sit in schools.
You but definitely anyway. Assume that. Yeah, and the really other kind of sick thing is that we've heard from people that we're connected to up inside that in New York, people want the industry jobs because the other jobs that Cole outlined, like, you know, maintaining the prison, people are making anywhere between 0 cents to 3 cents an hour. So there's a competition for these jobs where you're making $1.06 or 80 cents an hour. So it's really the prison system forces this to happen. And I think we'll talk about it a little bit later, but we're seeing now a lot of people that we know locally just up in the Bronx being also pushed into these conditions while their families kind of sit back and watch them be about to rot away upstate in these conditions.
Michael, how is the New York committee supporting the prison labor strike?
So the New York chapter of the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee got started back in November last year by some of our comrades that helped set up a chapter in Rochester, New York City, and Providence. And we're fairly new, but since we started up, we've been in contact with previous IWOC members that were in contact with Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee National. And we're also building new contacts with people inside prisons in New York State, specifically in the facilities that Cindy mentioned that produce industry products for the company Corecraft. So there's over a dozen companies in New York State that produce these products, and we've been sending cold letters into these prisons to try to talk with people about their conditions there. And across the board, we found that conditions are horrible. People are not getting paid enough. They need more money and want to, you know, support their families but are unable to. So since we only started in November and more so in earnest only a few months ago talking to folks in New York State prisons, we're starting to develop contacts and put people in touch with each other. But we haven't been able to really see any solid actions happen with this short notice.
Well, Cole, I understand, certainly. I think there were 24 to 26 states where there was organizing going on towards the initiation or the commencement of the strike on September 9th. I wonder if you can talk about the issue of how the organizing ensued, which is, you know, fascinating, how people behind the walls can get out the word. It's not entirely clearly through supporters. So what was that like? What was the organizing process? And what are people actually organizing to? Is it forming a union? Is it being treated equivalently to civilian employees? What are the predominant issues?
There's different demands depending on whatever location they're at. So South Carolina prisoners have created a list of demands. In Alabama, they have a freedom bill that they're trying to push. Here in Merced, we have two county jails where there are five different blocks that are all on hunger strike. We also have the women's prison in Chowchilla that they're on lockdown because they have refused to work. So we have a number of what we consider it's what happened was is because we've been preparing for it since like April or when the call came out around April, administration got wind of it. So rather than give the glory to the prisoners and let that potentially create a firestorm across the country, they preemptively put most of these institutions on lockdown where we have members or where we're corresponding regularly through letter writing and things like that. But now we also have a big part of IWALK as well is including family members. So, you know, we get information through family members, we get information through phone calls, we get information through letters. It's no secret that there's contraband cell phones within the prisons in this country, and that's why FAM has been so has been able to get the word out so well through their YouTube channel, through being able to have Skype interviews with KFPA and other other people like that. So we utilize that where we have it, and where we don't, we have to rely on snail mail. But we're getting a process better equipped to be able to respond. So in a lot of ways, you know, you send like, for example, here in California, I'll send a couple newsletters to one cell block, and it'll be passed along, you know, if you've got 50 in a cell block or whatever it might be, you know, that information gets passed along relatively quickly. So one or two members that we might have in a cell block, and then we'll get a call, letters back saying, I want information. So we have over 200 members in California. Now, the other important part I wanted to bring up is that while there are demands, we see this connection between the school-to-prison pipeline, the fact that police are indiscriminately killing black people, mass incarceration, the war on drugs, this continuation of white supremacy and institutional racism. So these respective demands, obviously, we fight for and we're pushing for, but at the end of the day, we see it as one system, and we want to end that system in and of itself. So a good quote that I always like to use from the initial call for all prisoners to go out was to cease reproducing institutions of your confinement. So basically, to quote from Melvin Ray, if we take the incentive away from the state and these corporations to use prison labor, then they'll be forced to pay either other workers or have to figure something else out. They'll have to deal. They'll have to negotiate. So, yeah, we do. As George Jackson claimed before he was executed in San Quentin, he said all prisoners should be unionized in one union and be able to collectively bargain. In 1977, the Supreme Court said they couldn't. That doesn't mean that, especially in the IWW, we really don't care what the government says, because we know that solidarity and sticking together means more than any law they can make.
Well, we all hear that, and we're all smiling, actually. I just want to, about your personal interest as we continue this, we have certainly in studio two young people, and I'm interested in why they care about these issues, and I'm interested in your particular interest, and also, Cole, what you know of other punitive action that has been taken against people who were participants or efforts to participate in this strike.
Sure. Yeah, my personal connection is I was incarcerated in Michigan for 3 years for delivery of narcotics. And it was while I was incarcerated that I kind of got reacquainted. Prior to going to prison, I was politically active young person, and then got involved with drugs, like a lot of people my age did around me at that time. I did my 3 years, but during that time, it was a young member of the Nation of Islam, and it was through our discussions that it kind of got repoliticized. We had a lot of discussions on race and class, and the distinction, you know, of course, that I always pointed out right away was the clarity on a clarification on the white man as the pig. And as we walked the yard, I remember Isaiah X, he would tell me, he said, Cole, you don't have any power over me any more than anybody else on this yard does. To me, or at least his understanding as he explained it to me, was that they saw the white man as the power structure, or those judges, landlords, police officers that had now for centuries been the ones oppressing them. So through that, we started using a portion of his Nation of Islam time in what we called community development program. And initially, we just talked about how we all got there and then talked about the system, railed about the system a bit. But I was always real open and honest about my experience being a white man and through the system, being in the same room. At one point, there was 12 of us, and I was the only white person at the beginning. And, you know, I was always very honest about the fact that all the money I made selling drugs, I had to give to a lawyer, number one. So I did get a good lawyer. But despite that, the fact that I got 3 years for the charges that I had when I was sitting in a room with black men who got three times as much time for a similar type charge. The fact that we were able to discuss those things, and then we developed and branched out because the state didn't offer any resources. They give you a bus ticket and say, here you go, go back home, get a job, be a productive member of society. Well, what we did as a group amongst ourselves, self-organized, was if we knew a member of our little group was getting out anytime soon, we tried to collect resources for education, if they needed their GED, housing, if they needed it, shelters or any other type of housing. And any potential work, you know, like temporary work or anything else that we could direct them towards before they got out to try to assist them. So in a way, it was trying to take the power and try to empower ourselves through that way. So a month after I got out in 2004, I joined the Industrial Workers of the World. And I've been organizing ever since with the IWW, kept at my dues ever since. So it was a couple of years ago when IWOC formed. I moved out here to California, and I was asked by some other members of the IWW, because of my experience being incarcerated, if I'd be willing to start corresponding with inmates here in California. So I was kind of recruited to IWOC, but I'm glad I was, because I remember what it meant to me to receive support and to know that people didn't forget about me on the outside. So I'm glad to be able to do that for others now.
And we're glad as well.
And Michael, prisoners are really paid nothing, or they're paid like 23 cents an hour or something like that. And there are over 900,000 prisoners who are working in the institutions, and most of these institutions depend heavily on the prison labor to function. If wages were raised to an even minimum wage, would that have an impact on the system of mass incarceration?
Yeah, I think the question of raising income to minimum wage is actually antithetical to the system of prison that we have, because prison itself is created to take away black men out of their homes and keep them economically, financially, oppressed. And the prison uses black men as slave labor. So. And this is taking resources out of black and brown communities. So the idea of paying them minimum wage, of course, it goes against the nature of the prison system. Certainly folks that are locked up would like to be able to work for their families and provide for their families while they're locked up and not be a financial liability for their families. So it would definitely help a lot, and I think it's the minimum that people need in prisons to get paid for their labor and not remain slaves.
Now, I just want to switch gears a little bit. This is an ongoing topic for us, so we welcome all of you back, and we'll continue to pursue it. And this is all part of a series we're doing, Shut 'em Down, because, frankly, the issue is ultimately prison abolition. But I mm-hmm. want to ask both Cindy and Michael a little bit. We have very limited time, but a little bit about some of these arbitrary raids in our communities, in public housing projects in particular, where they pick up people en masse. Why don't you talk about some of those so-called gang raids and what you also, as activists, have been doing in relationship to that?
So real quick, what a lot of people are talking about and recognizing is that just at the moment where Stop and Frisk was challenged in New York City, we've seen a shift immediately to so-called gang raids where police are no longer picking up to the same extent black and brown men off the streets, but going into their homes and communities to take them out of their beds at night. So this started happening last year with a very large raid on the Grant houses in Harlem, where over 100 young men were taken in. And just recently on April 27th in Eastchester, Bronx, 120 young men were taken in the middle of the night and caught up on RICO charges. And now they're sitting in prison in MDC and MCC in Brooklyn
and Manhattan.
They're
in federal prison, actually, right?
Yep. The raids were conducted by federal government, including ICE, the feds, and many other agencies.
Homeland Security was involved, I believe.
Seven agencies. Over 700 officers for 120 people.
So what we're seeing is, this process where men are taken out of their communities, and some of these men eventually be sent upstate and be some of the people that, you know, are working for very low wages and things like this. So as members of IWOC, we're not just trying to fight and organize with people already in prisons, but we want to get at the issue where it starts, which is police in the community.
Well, lastly, but I want to know how people can get in touch with, get involved in the Black Rose Anarchist Federation, get involved in the IWOC committee, the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, and also how people can find out more about the strike. So let's start with Cole Dorsey. How can people find out more about the strike? This is just the first salvo. It's an ongoing effort until we build that wall-to-wall union of prison labor, workers of the world, because indeed we have nothing to lose, literally and figuratively, but our chains. How do people find out more about it, Cole?
Yeah, absolutely. It's iwalk.noblogs.org. And we'd also encourage you to go support prisonerresistance.net and, of course, the freealabamamovement.com.
Well, listen, thank you very much for being with us and for all the organizing that you do and for the information you're imparting to us. And we're there to support our sisters and brothers inside. And next time, we also have to find out a little bit more about the sisters who are organizing, which sometimes we have a tendency to forget are part of the process. So thanks for the good work. And Michael, Cindy, how do people get in touch with you folks up here to support the parents and families of those young people who are picked up in these outrageous, arbitrary, conspiratorial raids, and there's not a smoking gun there amongst any of the people who are being held. And we should say they're being held mostly in federal prison. They've had no right to see a judge. The charges are, as most conspiracy charges, about indicting a ham sandwich. So how do people get in touch?
So the first thing that people can do is visit www.bronx120.org, and there you can donate, and you can also read a public letter from one of the mothers about the situation with her son and find out about information coming up. Real quick, there's two things coming up Wednesday at the base, which is located in Bushwick. There will be a call-in to support prisoners all over the country, and also we've heard that there's been retaliation and repression of the youth inside MDC and MCC because of their family members speaking out, particularly at our demonstration on September 9th. And you can get in touch with IWOC at iwoc.nyc@riseup.net.
Do that one more time.
So Bronx 120, BRONX120.org. And if you want to get in touch with IWOC, IWOC.NYC@riseup.net.
Well, we insist on you coming back. Let's get some of the parents here and let's really explore this issue and build the kind of support movement that we should. So we want to thank Cole Dorsey and Michael Forrest with the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, Industrial Workers of the World, and Cindy with IWOC. And, of course, Michael also is with the Black Rose Anarchist Federation. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure. Thanks. Thank you.
Thanks, Cole. Thank you, guys.
Inmates in as many as 40 prisons in 24 states across the U.S. are on strike, refusing to work in protest to what they call modern-day slavery.
The 13th Amendment of the Constitution of the United States assures that slavery will be abolished except for those incarcerated, which means if you have been convicted of a crime and you are serving jail time in a prison, post-trial, post-conviction, it is perfectly legal for the government to enslave you and to conscript you into labor that you don't necessarily want to perform for a pittance of a salary.
But in places like Texas, Arkansas, and Georgia, inmates are not paid at all. At times, work is performed for private, for-profit companies like Walmart, Victoria's Secret, and IBM. It's not just fair wages that they're calling for, but rather wide-scale reforms within the prison system.
From prison rape elimination, to access to medical care, to oversight that includes due process methodologies installed to protect these vulnerable populations are all part of this suite of demands that prisoners, inmates, and the incarcerated population across America is calling for.
The protests have been organized by the inmate-led Free Alabama Movement and coordinated by the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, along with the support of other groups.
The exact number of prisoners participating in the strike is unclear because authorities at correctional facilities have not made the numbers public. However, organizers say they're able to receive periodic updates and the strike is indeed ongoing.
The strike comes on the 45th anniversary of the Attica prison uprising, when inmates in the notorious New York correctional facility revolted and demanded better living conditions. However, it's clear many of the reforms demanded over four decades ago have yet to be addressed. Susan Madaris, Press TV, New York.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
It's been probably 15 minutes since the Legislative Assembly has passed that law to standardise the age of consent for all lawful sexual activity in Queensland, a reform that is long overdue.
I'm a playwright who happens to be gay. Does that make me a gay playwright? I don't know. A lot of people are rebelling without knowing how to fix anything. We've got death ahead of us, all of us, and we better participate in living as much as we can, as long as we can.
Topple the patriarchy!
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Northern Ireland stands alone after Guernsey approves marriage equality, Queensland crowns age of consent equality, and Edward Albee takes a vow. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Frances O'Brien.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending September 24th, 2016. By a vote of 33-5, lawmakers on the island of Guernsey, an autonomous British Crown dependency, approved a bill on September 21st to open civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples. Passage follows similar successful campaigns in the Isle of Man and Jersey. Ellie Jones is vice president of Liberate, a pro-marriage equality group. "We are ecstatic that Guernsey is now a more equal place to live," she said, "and that the states have demonstrated their support for LGBTQ islanders, some of whom have waited a very long time to be able to get married." The new legislation must now be officially approved by the Privy Council. But barring any unexpected bumps on the way down the aisle, the first weddings of gay and lesbian couples in Guernsey are expected to take place by the middle of next year. Northern Ireland is now the only part of the British Isles where civil marriage is denied to same-gender couples. The ruling Democratic Unionist Party has blocked every effort to even introduce a civil marriage equality bill in Parliament.
Chile's president, Michelle Bachelet, told the United Nations panel on LGBT rights this week that her government has committed to submit to Congress a bill on marriage equality during the first half of 2017. Furthermore, she added, it will also consider governmental support for several measures destined to strengthen the rights of the LGBT community, including reforms to anti-discrimination laws. The Chilean Congress created civil unions for gay and lesbian couples only last year, but opening civil marriage to them, according to LGBT advocacy groups, would provide those couples with added benefits, including welfare and state life insurance rights, in addition to clarifying adoption laws. Elsewhere in South America, Argentina, Brazil, and Uruguay have already opened civil marriage to same-gender couples.
LGBT Pride was peacefully celebrated in Belgrade on September 18th. An estimated 5,000 police officers protected several hundred Pride paraders as the procession wound its way through the center of the Serbian capital city. Belgrade's mayor and other local and national government officials and foreign diplomats were among the marchers. Pride has had a rocky history in Belgrade, ranging from outright government bans to violent attacks on parades by far-right extremists when they were allowed to go on. In 2010, at least 100 people were injured when homophobic protesters threw gasoline bombs at the marchers and the police officers trying to protect them. Belgrade authorities refused to sanction annual Pride celebrations again until 2014. With a large invisible police presence, Pride celebrations have been relatively peaceful since then. Armored police vehicles were deployed along this year's parade route, and a police helicopter circled above the march to deter potential violence, but no incidents were reported. Organizers said the theme of the 2016 Pride Parade was "Love Changes the World."
In other news, the leader of Australia's leading opposition Labour Party, Bill Shorten, confirmed this week that his MPs will join the minority Greens and a handful of independent lawmakers to oppose a proposal by the Liberal National Coalition government to hold a national referendum on marriage equality. Political analysts predict that combined opposition may be enough to defeat a bill to establish the referendum or plebiscite that's expected to be introduced soon in Parliament. Liberal Party Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull recently announced that the non-binding public vote would be held on February 11th and that it would cost $170 million, including $7.5 million each for the yes and no campaigns. Opponents have condemned the plebiscite proposal not only because of its cost, but because citizens would be required to vote or be fined. But anti-equality MPs would not be forced to ratify what polls consistently predict would be a landslide popular vote in favor in a formal marriage equality bill to follow. The results of recent elections suggest majority support now exists in Parliament, even among some members of Prime Minister Turnbull's own Liberal Party, for legislation to open civil marriage to same-gender couples, another point anti-plebiscite forces are making. But Turnbull has thus far refused to allow his MPs a free vote on any marriage equality bill.
LGBT rights advocates have also expressed fears that a potentially ugly political campaign around the plebiscite would encourage homophobic and transphobic violence, especially against younger LGBT people or those perceived to be. There was a stark reminder of that possibility this week when a bomb threat forced the evacuation of Melbourne-based Joy FM, Australia's only all-queer radio station. The threat was sent via email and condemned discussions of marriage equality on the station. It prompted a security lockdown and police response. Happily, no device was found and no one was hurt. A statement by the station said the threat highlights the damage that can be done through a divisive public debate about our community's aspiration to be equal members of society. Meanwhile, a group called Children's Future, which reportedly has links to the secret Roman Catholic religious society Opus Dei, has already started spreading fear-mongering falsehoods about marriage equality in flyers distributed throughout suburban Sydney this week. The group's three directors have been identified as members of the New South Wales Liberal Party. The Sydney Morning Herald newspaper says the trio is known locally as the Taliban because of their hardline religious views.
Officials in the U.S. city of Charlotte have firmly rejected a plan floated last week by a North Carolina business lobby group with the support of Republican Governor Pat McCrory for lawmakers to repeal the state's odious anti-LGBT HB2 if the Charlotte City Council first repeals its ordinance protecting LGBT people from discrimination. That measure in the state's largest city prompted the hasty passage in March by the Republican-dominated legislature of HB2, which bans local governments from passing similar anti-bias laws and requires trans people to use birth certificate-based public bathrooms. The state has already lost hundreds of millions of dollars because of anti-HB2 boycotts by a number of high-profile entertainers and by business, philanthropic, faith, and collegiate and pro sports organizations. "We appreciate the state wanting to find a solution to the challenges we are facing," said Mayor Jennifer Roberts, a Democrat, "which the state can do at any time without any action from the city of Charlotte."
We reported last week that the U.S. Army had agreed to provide whistleblowing transgender private Chelsea Manning the reassignment surgery she's been asking for since being jailed in 2013 for sending hundreds of thousands of classified U.S. government documents and videos to the WikiLeaks website. She's serving a 35-year sentence at the Brig in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. Last week's announcement about the pending surgery ended Manning's brief 5-day hunger strike that she said she began to call attention to her depressing situation. She had tried to kill herself in July. And Reuters reported that she was seemingly punished by a military court this week to 2 weeks of solitary confinement for failing in that effort and for having a disallowed book in her cell about the computer hacker group Anonymous. A group supporting her says that Manning can appeal the sentence if she wants to, and a week of the punishment could be suspended if she stays out of trouble for the next 6 months. The group said that Manning could be eligible for parole after serving 7 of her 35-year sentence.
And finally, genocidal homophobic U.S. hate preacher Stephen Anderson, who was denied entry last week into South Africa and the United Kingdom, didn't accomplish what he thought he could in Botswana. The pastor of Phoenix, Arizona's Faithful Word Baptist Church infamously celebrated June's Pulse massacre in Orlando, Florida, by telling his flock that there were now 50 less pedophiles in the world. He's also called for the execution of all gay people by stoning to rid the world of AIDS. Anderson had bragged on his Facebook page after being rejected by both South Africa and the UK that his crusade would get a warmer reception in Botswana. but he was deported from the Southern African country this week after calling for a gay man to be put to death during a national radio interview. "I hate homosexuals," he said. "I think they're evil haters of God." Botswana is not exactly known as a bastion of liberty for sexual minorities, which is probably what prompted Anderson's visit. But the country's president, Ian Khama, took credit for deporting the anti-gay pastor. "I said they should pick him up and show him out of the country," Khama claimed. "We don't want hate speech in this country. Let him do it in his own country."
That's NewsWrap for the week ending September 24th, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Frances O'Brien.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
Queensland says hello to a new way of life, and the world says goodbye to a literary icon later in the program. Amazon's quirky and queer comedy series about a family whose patriarch becomes a matriarch was a repeat winner at the 68th Annual Primetime Emmy Awards on September 25th. Transparent's Jeffrey Tambor accepted his Outstanding Lead Actor in a Comedy Series trophy by wishing himself out of a job.
"I'm not going to say this beautifully, but to you people out there, you producers and you network owners and you agents and you creative sparks, please give transgender talent a chance. Give them audition. Give them their story. And also, one more thing, I would not be unhappy were I the last cisgender male to play a female transgender on television."
Transparent creator and Outstanding Comedy Series director Jill Soloway made her Emmy speech even more political and saluted the Amazon ally who greenlighted the show.
"When you take women, people of color, trans people, queer people, and you put them at the center of the story, the subjects instead of the objects, you change the world, we found out. We found out. But I want to thank you, my sweet Jeff Bezos, because you changed the world. And you invited me to do this thing that these people call television, but I call a revolution. I've always wanted to be part of a movement. Civil rights movement, the feminist movement. This TV show allows me to take unlikable Jewish people, queer folk, trans folk, and make them the heroes. Thank you to the trans community for your lived lives. We need to stop violence against transgender women and topple the patriarchy. Topple the patriarchy."
In other Emmy news, out lesbian actress Sarah Paulson honored the out gay producer of American Horror Story and The People vs. O.J., both of which garnered her nominations. When Paulson accepted the Outstanding Lead Actress in a Limited TV Series for the latter, she also blew a kiss to her real-life romantic interest, who won the hearts of television viewers as Evelyn Harper on 2½ Men.
"Ryan Patrick Murphy, I owe you everything. It was because you thought I could that I even dared. You have been the most tried and true boss man, collaborator, mentor, and most importantly, my beautiful friend. You changed my life. And Holland Taylor, I love you. Thank you."
"I decided to become a playwright because I failed at everything else."
We'll dim the lights of Broadway for a fond farewell. But first,
"Everyone thinks that I'm a freak, the way I dress, the way I speak. I'm too thin, I hate my voice. I'd switch lives if I had the choice. I'll be tall and rich someday. Everything will go my way. Someday, someday."
It used to rival Tasmania as Australia's most repressive anti-LGBT place to live, But like the island state, Queensland has made great strides towards equality in recent times. This way out Brisbane correspondent John Frame reports on the latest advance.
Cameron Dick, Minister for Health in Queensland. Welcome to This Way Out.
Thanks.
We've just had the passing of a health bill which has enabled, for the first time in Queensland, an equal age of consent at 16.
It's been probably 15 minutes since the Legislative Assembly of Queensland has passed that law to standardise the age of consent for all lawful sexual activity in Queensland, a reform that is long overdue.
The number of votes for was so huge, like 72 for, only two against.
And I acknowledge everyone in the Parliament who supported this reform, so not just the government, the opposition, independent members of Parliament supported this legislative reform measure. Only two members of the 89-member Parliament voted against it, formally voted against it. A number of members abstained. So I think that's a sign that Queensland has changed, that our state has changed, that it is now, well and truly, at least in the 20th century, but I think it's probably in the 21st century now, and we want a society based on fairness and equality.
Michael Scott, Executive Director of the Queensland AIDS Council. This is a reform that's now 26 years in the making.
What it really means is that young people who are having sex can now be tested for a range of STIs, including HIV, without the risk of feeling as though they've done something wrong, without the feeling that they've been dirty, and without the feeling that they'll be discriminated against by their GP or by other people.
There are a number of reasons why this reform should have happened, as in youth deserve to live free from discrimination. They should have equal benefit and protection of the law. But the government, the Palaszczuk Labor government, decided to go with the health angle and the fact that they should be able to deal with their GP in an honest manner. And do you see that it will help the function of the Queensland AIDS Council in their work as well?
I certainly do, because we're already seeing young people who are presenting at our clinic that we run, and we know that young people are saying, well, actually I am having sex at the moment, but I'm reluctant to talk about it openly because I'm fearful that the police might charge me or charge my partner. And I think we will actually see a group of young people who will now come out from the age of 16 and say, well, actually, I've been having sex for a while and I'd like to be tested for HIV. I'd like to be tested for chlamydia or gonorrhea or syphilis because my sexual health is important to me.
Cameron Dick, this is just one of a number of extremely progressive reforms by the Palaszczuk Labor government in Queensland, and we're going to see a couple of others coming up.
Yeah, it's an interesting time, John, because we're a minority government. We don't have a majority in the Legislative Assembly. We only have 42 seats out of 89, so we're dependent on at least three other members of Parliament supporting us. But we've been able to reform our law in relation to civil unions for gay Queenslanders, so their relationship can be properly recognised under the law of Queensland. We've got reforms coming through in relation to changing the law of provocation in the criminal context. That's to remove the gay panic defence from the law in Queensland, and also steps being taken by the government to expunge historical homosexual convictions, which is an important law reform measure which we see reflected in the reform we've seen through the Parliament today. So there are some things that are happening that shows Queensland continues its progression to fairness and equality, and I'm delighted to be part of that government.
My sincere congratulations and thanks to you.
Thanks to you, John, and everyone who's campaigned so long and hard for this It's a privilege for me to be able to work for you in the Parliament and for a lot of people, particularly young people who need the law changed.
That was Queensland Health Minister Cameron Dick, and I'm John Frame in Brisbane for This Way Out.
I'm Michael Cunningham, author of The Hours and By Nightfall. And you're listening to This Way Out, the international radio magazine for all our sexually diverse communities.
Edward Albee took his final bow on September 16th. One of the most honored playwrights of the 20th century, the openly gay theater genius won 3 Pulitzer Prizes, 3 Tony Awards, and many more honors for works that took on artificial social values, condemned complacency, and stood, in his words, against the fiction that everything in this slipping land of ours is peachy keen. Albee spoke in 2009 with This Way Out correspondents Dixie Trichel and John Townsend.
I was an orphan. I was adopted into a rich family. Their values were, I thought, pretty unfortunate. Even very young, I didn't like their values. Their family took me down to Palm Beach, Florida every winter when they had a house on the ocean. You can't imagine how terrible Palm Beach was. Black people had to leave the island of Palm Beach by sunset. Of course, no Jews were allowed to have property there. How I turned out to be a human being, in spite of all of that, I really don't know. Maybe because I was not theirs.
As you were deciding to become a playwright...
I decided to become a playwright because I failed at everything else.
You wrote some fiction and poetry as well,
oh,
right?
Sure. I started off with poetry. I wrote the 2 worst novels that could ever be written by an American teenager. But I figured out that I was a writer since I was incompetent to become a composer, which is what I wanted first.
Oh, I notice in your plays that they're very musical.
Yeah, they are indeed.
Some of your influences.
Well, I had more influences than you can possibly imagine since I read more than most kids, listened to more classical music than most kids, and looked at art more than most kids did. So I was being happily bombarded constantly by the other arts.
What happened then when you actually began to write plays?
With the exception of one play I wrote when I was 12 and a half, the exception of that, I didn't write my first play, The Zoo Story, until I was 28, and I'd failed at all other branches of writing. When I wrote The Zoo Story, I realized, Edward, this is better than anything else you've ever written, and this may be okay. When I wrote that play, I had a sense, you know?
How do you think American theater has changed from when you were young to what's happening today?
The terrible commercial things that have happened to theater. The awful killing hand of commerce has really done serious damage to our theater. The costs of producing a play now are prohibitive, and the cost of an audience going to a play is absolutely ridiculous. Mm-hmm. When we did my play, The Zoo Story, on Crap's Last Tape off Broadway in 1960, the tickets were $2.50. Now off-Broadway, the tickets are $75, and inflation hasn't done that. With inflation, it would only be a third of that. All of the costs have gone up, and so you can't get young people going to the theater, and you can't get low-income people going to the theater, and that's who we need there.
You've talked about the need for people to be rebellious and for young people to rebel against things, and that comes up in your plays.
Yeah, but only against the things that should be rebelled against. That's what's wrong with our educational system. We don't educate people in something that used to be called civics, where you were taught how government functions and where the errors are. And nobody's taught that stuff anymore, so a lot of people are rebelling without knowing how to fix anything. I used to talk to students in the early 60s during the rebellious times, and their hearts were in the right place, their minds were in the right place, but you couldn't talk dialectic to them for more than 2 minutes before they were out of their depth. That was a shame. If they'd known more specifically about how to fix what they were angry about, we could have accomplished a lot more.
Mr. Albee, you've talked about the need for arts education as well.
You can't have a civilization without a comprehensive arts understanding in the country. Our public schools do not teach the arts. I went to private schools, being adopted by that rich family. I went to private schools. I got a great education. And most people aren't getting that education now, and it's terrible. And we're supposed to be a civilization.
George and Martha. Sad, sad, sad.
Do you view your work as dark comedy?
I don't think in those terms. I think of what I write as plays. Dark comedy, light tragedy. No, I don't think in those terms. It's a play. It's something I want people to go to and pay attention to. What the characters say, what they don't say, what the meanings are, the implications are. Knowing that no two people see the same play, which is very important to remember.
You've always rejected labels, even the term absurdist playwright, even though you're considered by many people America's first great absurdist
playwright. Yeah, because most people don't know what the term means.
You've also rejected gay playwright.
Well, I'm a playwright who happens to be gay. Does that make me a gay playwright? I don't know. Maybe if you only write about gay themes, then you're a gay playwright. I don't know. All labels diminish in some way.
You did a lot of your formative artistic growth in Greenwich Village, and so there was quite a gay scene in that area.
Remember, my family sent me to private schools, and they sent me away to boarding schools, boy boarding schools. I came out as soon as it was possible, and I've enjoyed being gay ever since. I had no trouble with it, whatever.
You were friends with Ned Roram, and...
Oh, sure, I still see Ned. He's doing pretty well. He gained a little weight, which he should lose.
Harold Pinter, the great British playwright, old friend of yours.
Harold and I were both very much affected by Sam Beckett, one of the greatest playwrights of the second half of the 20th century. But I think we both managed to develop our own sound and our own language, so the influence was helpful and not limiting. I admired Harold's political stances, and I admired his plays a lot, and we liked each other a lot.
Is there a play that you've written that you like more than others?
It's always the one that I'm writing now.
And are you writing one now?
I'm writing two.
I
always have two in my head. One is a relief from the other.
Now, you're going to tell us what they are?
No. What if I'm wrong?
Going to the theater should make you participate in your own life. You've said things to that effect.
I don't think you should go to the theater and not have anything happen to you. I think every time you go to any art experience, you should be changed, or you should learn something about yourself that you didn't know before. That's the only way you can keep your own intellect evolving.
You speak about death in your plays a lot.
Well, there are only two things to write about, life and death.
And which is your favorite?
You know, we've got death ahead of us, all of us, and we better participate in living as much as we can, as long as we can.
Is there something that you really want people to know and nobody asks you?
After 35 years with a great lover, I've been single for 4 years now, in case anybody's interested in an 80-year-old.
That was famed playwright Edward Albee in conversation with John Townsend and Dixie Trico in early 2009. I don't like the idea of getting older and older, Albee once said, because there's meant to be a time when that has to stop. Dying strikes me as being a great waste of time.
Isn't life beautiful? Isn't life gay? Isn't life the perfect thing to pass the time away?
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Wenzel Jones, Francis O'Brien, John Frame, and Dixie Trickle and John Townsend contributed program material, with thanks as always to Steve Pride. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this show possible. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For associate producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WNJR Washington, Pennsylvania, 2NSB Chats with New South Wales, KLAI Fort Bragg, Laytonville, and Willits, California, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
The studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. You can talk about debt. You can write about the world of finance. You can analyze trends in banking and credit. Or you can make art. You can use that to send a message, to express an opinion about what debt is doing to individuals and societies, to our society. Cassie Thornton has a lot of opinions about debt and financial systems because she's done a lot of research and because she, like many of us, has experienced debt firsthand. Thornton is an artist, a social practice artist, whose projects have raised a lot of eyebrows for their unconventional, experiential, and at times in-your-face aspects. Today, you'll hear about two of Cassie's projects, one that involved hiring someone to have breakdowns, yes, nervous breakdowns, on the campus of the art school she attended, and another that involved touching surfaces in banking institutions and using the accumulated dust and dirt to create drawings of a sort. Cassie Thornton received a Master of Fine Arts, or MFA, degree from the Bay Area-based California College of the Arts and a BFA from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She works under the title of the Feminist Economics Department, or the Fed. So what we'll present today is first portions of a lecture that Cassie gave at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, and then Cassie will talk with me in more depth about some of the issues raised in that lecture. I want to thank the Evergreen Art Lecture Series for making the audio available. Here's Cassie Thornton speaking in Olympia last October.
So I went to school, I went to undergraduate in University of Wisconsin in Madison. I went out of state. I was the first person in my family to go to college. I think I had about $40,000 of debt when I graduated. And I worked my ass off through my 20s to pay that off. And I paid $15,000 of it off. And then I went to grad school. And I went to a fancy private art school, California College of the Arts, for 2 years. Where each year was $38,850 per year, and I got about half of that, about $20,000 knocked off for a scholarship. And then I also took out money. I'll explain a little bit about how I used some of my money when I was in grad school, but I got a little extra money to live on, to make work with. But in the end, I think I should only have about $55,000 of debt. Like $55,000 that I actually said, like, this is the amount of money that I want to spend on my education. The rest is interest. The rest is interest. And where is that money going? I could tell you where the money's going, but you could also guess where the money's going, because the United States spends 8% of its entire budget on education. So it's become very, you know, obvious in the news. Like, Elizabeth Warren has made it very clear that the Department of Education definitely profits off of student loans. And, you know, there's lots of different news to read about that's actually really promising about that stuff, like the Corinthian 15 or the Debt Collective, who are getting groups of people from for-profit colleges to strike against their debt really publicly. They're revealing all kinds of information, and they're actually working with the Department of Education in really interesting ways. So a lot about this stuff, I have a feeling, will change. But right now, in the last 2 years, I've accrued $17,000 of interest. And then in the 2 years that I was in grad school, that was another 20. That's amazing. So anyway, I just feel like it's such a waste of time. It's just a waste of time and energy, and it's not real. It's a fiction. And so where does it start? It starts in the financial aid department. I had a very fancy financial aid department at the California College of the Arts. I didn't even take a picture of it because I got kicked out of it so many times. But it was as if in the financial aid department, I couldn't make decisions. I felt like I was surrounded in fog. I was completely detached from myself. I did not have use of my mind. And I said yes to a lot that I didn't necessarily agree to. And over and over again, I had this feeling in grad school of just being covered in fog. And I used to think that maybe the fog was debt itself, but I actually think that debt might generate anxiety, and I'm seeing anxiety. Like, it's like condensation. So I've been dealing with this fog in a lot of different ways. But I think the interesting thing, I mean, one interesting way to think about it is like the sort of motion it creates. Like, you try to move fog out of the way, and you can only comb it, but it just comes back. You can't capture it. You can't contain it. You can't actually, like, consolidate it and move it. It just feels like a familiar feeling. So I did a lot when I was in grad school to try to deal with this fog. Like, I really wanted to cut through it somehow. And I failed in so many ways trying to do it. But one way that I think I really hit it on the head was that I realized that I did not have the power to kind of cut through the fog. Like, I felt like I wanted to scream and yell and, like, break things, but I didn't have the guts to really, like, rupture any part of the institution myself. But I did have way more money in my bank account than I was used to, so I decided to hire an actress to play a student while I was in grad school. And so I put an ad on Craigslist, and I offered to pay someone $250 to have a breakdown. And so I found this person named Lara, and her character's name was Fedora Archive. And what we did was every Friday, I actually ended up hiring her for the entire second year of my graduate school, and I ended up meeting with her every Friday and telling her everything I was learning about finance, about the school, about the San Francisco art scene, and then she would go and have a very precise breakdown somewhere in the school. The breakdowns happened at the cafeteria or in the hallway or inside of one of my classes. She had a studio that I got her, so she was this sort of interesting, mythical presence in graduate school. And she also became sort of my best friend. And I think we kind of completed each other in a way. Here she is at the MFA show, which should have been my MFA show, but was her MFA show, where we painted the walls black, and all she showed was her resume, her press page, and her biography. And I made all those documents. And when people entered, and they said, well, she approached every person that came into her room, and she would say, you know, have you seen my work? And they'd be like, well, I saw your resume, but what did you make? Like, what do you do? And she was like, is that not enough? And then she'd be like, oh, no problem, I'll get my press kit. And so then she'd get her press page, and they'd look at it, and she'd be like, so, like, how about now? And then they'd say, well, I was really wondering about, you know, what you make. And then maybe she'd get her biography. But anyway, it would go and go, and she'd get more and more frustrated. She really scared people. Like, is nothing I do enough for you? And then every half hour throughout the night, she ended up having a breakdown. And they were timed, and they happened quite naturally because it was very easy to want to have a breakdown for her. But she had this little rug where she would take her shoes off and put her things down and then have a throwdown. And they lasted for about 5 minutes, and they changed in the course of the night. So at first, she was having breakdowns as a baby, as an infant, just using her whole body. And then throughout the night, she got older and more contained. And they were very scripted, actually. And they were really precise in that she, by the end, she was an old person. It was as if she couldn't let anything out of her body. She just shook. She didn't have that same fluidity that an infant has when they can't help but let their emotions take over their entire body. So that was intense, and it was interesting because in grad school, Fedora won a lot of different awards and scholarships, and a lot of people were very upset about it. And I left that project behind, as I do many of my projects, thinking I can't handle it anymore. It's too much. So I had this residency a few years later at the Headland Center for the Arts, which is an amazing place. And this is my studio. You know, it's like a dream. And I had no idea what I wanted to do in it. In fact, I just felt completely overwhelmed and kind of on parade. I had to have my studio open every day for 5 hours to the public, so it was really hard to work. But luckily, I got this invitation from University of California in San Diego, and they wanted to do a project about student debt. And it was very clear that they were the most interested in doing a Fedora archive project. So I worked with them, and they basically said, you know, they don't have money for performance, and they don't have money for an artist fee. They don't have money for a lecture. They only pay for materials. And I was like, well, the only materials I could give you are breakdowns, and those will cost $250 each. So I am very proud of the fact that I got University of California, San Diego to pay $250 per breakdown for a critique of their school, because that's what it was. So we went to microeconomics classes, or that was the plan. We're going to go to microeconomics classes. We're going to go to, you know, the cafeteria where there's a Chase Bank. You know, the whole place is just like a corporate megalomania. It wasn't hard to choose where we would have a breakdown or about what. The UC system raised its tuition 300% in 11 years. Like, it's more now, but then that's what it was. So there was lots to talk about. They'd also just hired the former Department of Homeland Security president. Janet Napolitano is the president of the UC system. So there's like a lot to talk about. But it became obvious that Lara, the old actress, couldn't do it. She just got pregnant. And I couldn't imagine paying someone only $750 for 3 performances without paying them to train. And so I didn't believe I could hire anybody for this amount of money. And these performances really changed Lara's life. This was very hard on her, on her body, on her mind. Like, I wouldn't just do this to anybody now that I saw what it was. And then I realized, like, actually, Fedora, I need to be Fedora. Fedora is me. It's a part of me, and I've never done it before, and I'm afraid to do it, so I should definitely do it. So I told them that, and so I decided to become this student who was, like, kind of everything I hated in a way. She was going to be this MFA student who very self-consciously performs breakdowns about her debt on campus. So in a way, she is me, and she's totally not me at the same time. So I made her business cards, and I made her this very forthright social climbing person in my mind. And I got a wig, and I started to, while I was at the Headlands, have meetings with Laura. And so Laura actually was the one that received all the money for the breakdowns. She received the $750 to train me how to have breakdowns. And I felt like it was this really important kind of reciprocity to do this, to go through the same thing she went through, and for her to see me do it and see it happened to me. And so I had a great time. This was me in the hallway practicing at University of California in Berkeley before I went there. I just practiced and practiced and practiced. As soon as I put the wig on, it was over. I have so much that I'm so angry about, and it's so cool to get to have a breakdown about it. So I don't have great documentation about this because I actually told them that they couldn't come. Like, the gallery, I became very close to the curator, Michelle Hune, who's an amazing person, and she was allowed to come through as the breakdowns were happening, but there was no documentation by the University of California, and it was not for them, it was for the students. So there's very few pictures, but this is a picture of the person standing next to me when I was in the first microeconomics class I was in, when they were talking about how we are going to now believe for the rest of our educations that we are living in a scarcity of time and energy, that we are all economic men, that we will all fight to the death to accumulate more capital than anyone else, that we must expect these conditions to kind of be the most basic conditions for all that we learn for the rest of our economics education. And so I had several interactions that were really loud with the professor of this class. And I never got kicked out, actually. She was really kind, but I just remember these shoes so well and what that represents. Here's me having a breakdown in the cafeteria, which was right next to Chase Bank. Chase Bank was inside of the cafeteria at UCSD, and there was this one day when they were passing out Sharpies. And the Sharpies were supposed to lure students in to get a credit card. And so I ended up getting underneath the table that had the blue tablecloth that where the Sharpies were and not moving. And the Department of Student Health came and spooned me until the paramedics came. And they were all standing around me, and like the managers of the building came, and I just sat up and I was like, I'm fine. This place isn't fine. It's f***ed up. And I told them why, and it was a pretty amazing moment. So I feel like I kind of got to break through some of that fog.
You are listening to an artist named Cassie Thornton giving a lecture at the Evergreen State College last October. Thornton's work focuses on debt and finance. She works under the title of the Feminist Economics Department. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Let's return to more of Cassie Thornton's talk.
Beginning in grad school, again, after I'd been kicked out of the financial aid office, I was just feeling really frozen in school, and I remember being in this drawing class where I felt like I just didn't have any interest in drawing. I didn't even want to, like, touch it because it felt like it was such a part of a dirty market. And finally I had an idea to make a drawing. It was, like, the last day of class, of drawing class, and I was supposed to show something. So I asked if everybody could wash their hands, and then we're going to go do a drawing together. And so we went to the financial aid office, and we went to the waiting room, and I asked everyone to just touch everything. Just touch everything as much as you can. Make it big. And try to find as much dirt as you can. And so these people are kind of like doing really cautious contact improv with the financial aid office, just like touching, like, you know, underneath the table or like where the brochures go or like by like the electrical outlet. It's like really, you know, it's really dusty and dirty, but this room was so white and like IKEA modern and stuff, so it seemed so clean and sanitized, but it was like so dirty. And so we made this drawing with all the dirt, and I thought it was like so awesome, you know. It was like so clear to me, like, and all the students in the room were like, yeah, it's like corruption, like we got dirt on them. And I'm like, actually, I just think it's skin cells. I think that it shows that we are at the center of what the financial aid office is supposed to be doing. We're humans. It's a human place. Financial places are human places, even though it doesn't feel like that. And so what ended up happening is that I did end up going to New York. I had a show at this amazing old nonprofit called Flux Factory in Queens. And they asked me to do a performance project. So I did. I hired 20 dancers to go to 20 banks and to touch everything. And so we practiced. Here's us on the outside of Chase Bank, where they're cleaning always, all night. And we just started by making small mistakes, like just touching things. And then we tried to make other mistakes, like here's one person using an ATM, and then here's two people using an ATM, and here's four people using an ATM. And so we're all practicing these little nervous experiments where we could just barely break the rules. I mean, it just broke us to break the rules because we were so scared and shaking. But eventually we began to start to be able to do slightly larger actions. So eventually we built up until we were really comfortable going to banks together. And our system was we would wash our hands outside of the bank together with a bucket and a soap. And then we'd go in, and there's between like 2 and 7 people usually going to the bank together. And then when we got inside, we would just ask the person in the front, oh, well, we would like to open a collective savings account. And they'd be like, okay, just a second. And then they'd go get the banker. And meanwhile, we're touching. And then the banker comes out and brings us to their office, to the back of the bank. And, you know, they're like, oh, so what's a collective savings account? And meanwhile, you know, it's like touching. And you know, we got really good at being like, well, we're performers and we're doing this project and we just need to all have access to the same funds because we're raising money. And they'd be like, well, so like, what's the project? What are you raising money for? And we're like, well, it's this. And they'd be like, so where, what do you mean this? When does it happen? And like, well, now. And, we ended up opening 20, you know, all 20 of the bank accounts. We opened all those savings accounts, and they all have between, like, some banks would let us open, like, 5 with 5 people on it. One bank let us have it with 11 people, and I still have all those accounts, like, sending me information, which is cool. But anyway, so we got really good at it, and it took us so long, though, to break through our own sense of, like, what was possible. Like, our own rules were so much tougher than the bank's rules. And we were so afraid of what could happen to us, but nothing ever happened to us. And finally, we had the guts to, like, step over our bounds. And what we did was we gave our bank account at this one TD Bank in Midtown Manhattan on 59th Street. We got a savings account there, and so we had a savings account number, and we gave this number out to tons of people. And we said, come and wait in line and make small deposits in our account, and that's a way to kind of watch what's going on. So for an hour, we're going to be performing, and you can come, and you know, you have this reason to be in the bank. And we filled the bank up. The line was out the door, and there's people on the floor touching everything. There's people, like, dumping the pens over, and, like, you know, it just became, like, just chaos. And then security finally came and got us and pulled us out. And I felt like it was such an amazing moment when we actually got strong enough to need to be disciplined. And so proud. So this is just some images of, like, the installation was at the Flux Factory, where these images of the handprints of the drawings of the dirt. We went to the Federal Reserve, to the museum. We were not allowed in the Federal Reserve. We went, you know, to banks all over, and so much developed out of that project. I obviously think about debt a lot, and I think that in talking about debt, I like to go with the idea that debt is something that is natural, that was not always corporate and was not always predatory. If we didn't have anything owed to anyone else, we would have nothing to do. We think of debt in this really flat way, like it's what I owe to the bank or to the student loan company, or I don't have debt, maybe you do, but I don't have debt. But I just don't think that's true. I don't think there's any living beings, well, I don't know about actually if animals have debt, but I don't think there's people that don't have a sense of owing or obligation to someone. And it does not necessarily mean that it's scary. It does not necessarily mean that it's oppressive. It's just a relationship. If you have me over for dinner, like, I want to do something for you, and I definitely want that relationship. Like, I want that feeling of striving to kind of please you, to meet you somewhere, to meet you where you are. And as David Graeber said, it was always there. Like, credit and debt, they were not preceded by barter. It was never just like a completely clean exchange. was always, there's always a layover. You always had something that I didn't have, and I had something you didn't have. And maybe those things linked up. And money was actually supposed to make it easier to exchange after credit had become messy. So I've been, you know, really for years thinking that debt means more than we think it does. And I keep thinking about this part of this Octavia Butler book. It's in this book called Lilith's Brood. And Octavia Butler is a science fiction writer, if you don't know her. And in this book, a very minor, I mean, that's not minor, but it's sort of something you could almost miss. This one storyline in it is that the Oankali aliens in the future have come to Earth, and they've tried to kind of save humans. And half of the humans are threatened and escape them. And half of them are kind of, like, subsumed and sort of join the Oankali culture and their very strange conception of, like, gender and sex. And but the amazing part to me is that the Oankali realize, and the humans never really do, that the most potent healing thing that the human body produces is cancer. And that cancer is the thing that can heal humans. So the Oankali collect people who have the cellular mutation that causes cancer, and they harvest the cancer. They don't kill the people to get it, but they get the cancer, and then they use it to heal other humans. But the thing that they heal in the humans is the humans' desire for hierarchy. And I think it took me a few years for this to blow my mind. Like, I read that, you know, 5 years ago or something. But I think that the reason I bring it up is that these things that are the most toxic substances, the things that are the scariest, the things that you want to avoid the most, are probably the richest. And that's why I love the elephant in the room, because it's probably a pretty powerful elephant or a pretty powerful something. And so that's why the debt is so interesting and unknown to me, because I think I'm looking at it in this way. Like, I wish I was an alien, because then I could see what things really were.
That's the artist Cassie Thornton speaking at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. I'm C.S. Song, and as I watched Thornton's lecture, many questions came to mind, questions she answered when she joined me recently in our KPFA Berkeley studios. After a short music break, we'll present that conversation with Cassie Thornton. Please stay with us. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. I recently sat down in studio with Cassie Thornton, a social practice artist whose work focuses on the impact of economic systems, including regimes of debt and finance, on what people do and think and believe. I asked Cassie what kinds of things Laura, the woman she hired while a student at California College of the Arts, the kinds of things Laura would say and express during her breakdowns.
She would bring up things about how expensive living in San Francisco was. She would bring up things about how she really didn't know how she would ever get a job given this degree and how much tuition was. And she would talk about sort of the general, like, social space of the school, how people aren't taking risks. Maybe they're using garbage in their art, and that they're really kind of happy being in little white rooms by themselves doing their own work, because they felt like
that was kind of all they could do or something like that. So she was talking about all the conditions in school and in the social space of the school that were representative to her of this sort of deeper indebtedness. And, you know, she would actually go up and approach people and be like, can you see what's going on? Like, what we're really making is debt, and your artwork is just a byproduct of that debt. And so can you see, like, what we're participating in? Can you feel it? Like, why aren't you saying anything? And people would just look at her like, you are crazy. Or they would look at her like, please don't do this. Please don't do this. Please don't do this. And so, it was a real mix. And I think, God, I can't even believe that Fedora, who's played by Laura Gold, I can't even believe, you know, what she kind of lived through in the coldness of people's responses, or like, you know, but it was really sort of this like magnified experience of the sociality of debt.
So if you were with her every time she had a breakdown, then what was that like for you to observe her expressing things that she was interpreting based on, or she was expressing based on her understanding of your situation, her hearing what you were going through and what your debt was like?
I mean, for me, it was extremely anxiety-provoking to watch her. I felt a lot of guilt because, in a way, she was performing what I couldn't perform, and she had told me many times that she was being me for me and doing things that I couldn't do for myself. And what she was doing was at times quite violent, like throwing herself on the floor or, you know, socially violent by crying or wailing or screaming in public in a place where things are very, like, seamed up and quiet and professional. And so I had a lot of guilt watching her and a lot of anxiety for the thing that I knew that she was kind of bringing to the surface, which is inherently a really uncomfortable thing. And also, this was before Occupy really blew up and made it possible to talk about debt and economic inequality. So it was really, really gut-wrenching. But at the same time, there's something about bringing something that is sort of underneath the surface to the surface that's also a total breath of fresh air and a total rush. So I was really proud of what was going on at the same time as I was feeling like I just wanted to sort of like scratch my eyes out.
So how would you evaluate the balance between personal and political in this particular project? How much of it was a kind of catharsis for you, a way for you to, or you to see someone else really bear their or your frustrations and anger at what was happening? And how much of it is, well, I have this political point and this political message that I really want to share with people and I want to convey to people? And how would you balance the personal issues and the political, the kind of the broader political issues with this action?
I think it's complicated for me. I think I'm in a special position where it's really personal and really political. But by that time, I don't think I was actually that riddled by my own debt. Like, I wasn't doing it for a sense of catharsis for myself. My political perspective comes from a personal desire to never be bored. I mean, I basically think that debt and people who are really obsessed with sort of like a sort of professionalization or becoming good economic players, I think those are the most boring people on earth. And I really want to interrupt that at the source. And so that's why I think educational institutions are so interesting as a forum for that. But yeah, I mean, all of these projects, it's interesting because I always knew I wasn't going to pay my debt. I always knew that I didn't believe in, like, money for corporate education. So in a way, I was sort of already healed, but I really don't want to be alone in that. And so this whole project has really been about trying to get as many other people on board with me as possible.
We also heard a portion of a talk earlier this hour that had to do with a project is called Physical Audit. You call it Physical Audit. It has to do with touching things, going into the financial aid department at CCA, going into banks in New York City to touch things, With automatic banking machines, there was some reference to it, but tell me more specifically what you and your group, your cohort, did in relation to these machines.
Yeah, so to begin with, we did a series of practices in ATM vestibules to kind of get ready for what was the larger project of physical audit. And so our practices were basically where I would come up with a series of scores or like sets of instructions or challenges for the dancers to kind of like take in and like embody and just, you know, play with and see what happened. But a lot of those things included just doing everything that a person has never done or never even imagined doing to an ATM, things that were very, like, very human. So just for example, one day we had one of the dancers bring a dog in, and so we brought the dog into the ATM vestibule, and there's about 10 dancers there, and they just rotated between, like, petting the ATM and petting the dog and petting the ATM and petting the dog. And so, I mean, I think all the things that we did were very much about just, like, making the financial space a living space, kind of by whatever means necessary. So other things were like more about a type of vulnerability. So we got the dancers to go into pairs, and one person had their eyes closed for the entire process, and the other person was sort of in control of the person with their eyes closed. They were sort of in control of that person's body. So the person that was being blind gave their debit card to the other person and, like, let that person sort of control them as they made a withdrawal or had a transaction on the ATM. And, you know, that sort of thing where two people are both sort of together using the ATM, kind of interdependent, but also one has the opportunity to take advantage of the other, though they didn't. Like, there's some just playing with vulnerability that was really important. And maybe the most interesting one was just asking 10 people to use the ATM at once, and just sort of seeing, like, how the dancers interpreted that, like, what kind of inventions they made somatically. It was really kind of an amazing amazing practice that evolved out of it, because I think that in general we got really used to making the banks a place that we could sort of play, like continue the way that we live outside of the banks, inside of the banks, which is, you know, we're living creatures that, you know, explore and have questions and make mistakes and, you know, make messes. And so we really brought that into the bank.
Yeah, and of course, you know, there are kind of bank rules and there are mores as far as what people can do or can't do in banks and spaces that comprise banks. And you refer in this talk, portions of which we aired earlier this hour, about kind of breaking through you and the dancers, our own sense of what was possible. You say at one point in the talk, our own rules were so much tougher than the bank's rules. Elaborate on that.
Well, it was fascinating as an experience to go into banks to kind of play, because the first set of ideas we had were just that we were going to go in and touch as many surfaces as we could. And I found myself so nervous that I couldn't actually even extend my arm away from my body. I couldn't really do anything. And I saw it in the other dancers as well. The first couple times that we went in, there was so much fear of kind of like messing up or messing around that I think we were really, really stiff. And we kept expecting that a security guard would come or that the police would come, and nobody ever came. And so we had so much anxiety about, like, what was going to happen to us, like, when we went to jail for going into a bank and touching things. And then time after time, there was just, like, there's no discipline. There was not even any attention paid to us. If anything, like, people actively ignored what was happening around them. And so, you know, there was these times when I could see, especially some of the more experienced dancers, going from being sort of, like, scared financial people to becoming like to sort of opening up and really interacting with the space of the bank. But I would say it took like 10 or 15 visits for some of us before we really started to be able to, like, feel a little bit free.
So how much of this project was about empowerment, maybe empowering people to act in certain ways that they wouldn't feel appropriate maybe beforehand? And how much of it was, and this is probably related, this sense of, you know, here's your body, and there are ways you can use your body that you don't think you can use your body to express yourself in even public places in a way that can carry forth a message, whether it's to yourself or to other people?
Yeah, I think that it's both. I mean, for the dancers that were involved, I've stayed in touch with them, with many of them, and we talk a lot about how it was sort of like a practice of sort of undoing our own sense of what was possible, given really sort of corporate, sterile places. So, yeah, I think that part of it is really very much about unschooling our own obedience. And I think it really worked. And I think that we can see that because of what a lot of those people are still doing now. I think it seems as if people were really affected, because I think a lot of those people are still really involved in activism and a sort of very physical civil disobedience in their practices. But also, it is very much about a sort of like a training around alternative activist strategies. There's a lot of subtlety to what we were doing, and it was something that was like actively witnessed by a lot of normal people just trying to do business or go through their daily lives. And I think that in terms of just thinking through how to make a spectacle and like how to make a statement, and the way that big finance and big politics actually like does become a material that you can work with in everyday life, like I think that it really did a lot for that. And yeah, so I feel like it's really trying to be a sort of somatic training for like activists to really think through like how we can inhabit space radically and like sort of stop business with our bodies.
Cassie Thornton is my guest on Against the Grain. I'm C.S. Song. She is an artist, and we have a link to her website. It's called the Feminist Economics Department, or the Fed, on our website, againstthegrain.org. Tell us about the drawings and the handprints that emerge from this, right? So they're touching these surfaces that are sometimes dirty, and that interrogates certain things about corporate and financial spaces that I hope you'll talk about a bit. And then what would they do with the material on their fingers?
The idea was really that like the bank is a living space, and that this dirt actually it's not like we're gathering dirt on corporations. We're actually like tracing the ways that like living still happens as a part of these bad institutions. Like even though they're sort of faceless and you know, we can't sort of understand, it's really hard to understand these companies as like human companies that are actually made to serve other humans. This dirt, which is actually like, you know, a mix of skin and like stuff that people have dragged in from the outdoors and like hair, like it's really living material. So to get it on our bodies was like totally disgusting because there was a ton of it, but also like as sort of like engaging with the idea that the bank is a living place and that we could somehow take it back. So then we would, at the end, like before we left the room of the bank, we would take out a clean piece of paper and just all rub our hands on it. And, you know, the piece of paper would become quite dirt, like really dirty. Like it was like really like, you know, these are dusty, dirty places, even though they appear very, very clean and very sanitized and controlled. Like they're really dirty, and the rubbings are quite amazing because it almost looks like, you know, people would put their hands on them and sort of drag them down. So you have these kind of like, they almost look like windows of prisons or something like that, or walls of prisons where you would see like a hand like scraping down the side of it, like dragging down the side of it, trying to escape or something like that. So they're these really kind of weird and dark drawings. And as portraits of these very clean places, I think that they're really sort of intense and strong images to look at.
So, Cassie, you've asked people, many people, what they would do if they had no financial limitations whatsoever. if money weren't an object? What have they told you, and what does that say to you about how important markets have come to be in our lives?
Well, when I asked people on the street how they would act or what they would do if they had no financial limitations, the answers were really disappointing. A lot of people said that they would go on vacation. One person said, you know, I would go to Europe. And I'm like, what would you do? And they said, well, I would eat really nice food. And then what? Well, I'd come back. After how long? Oh, like a month. Like, well, then what? I don't know. Maybe I'd go on another vacation. And over and over again, I just felt like people's imaginations were like really stumped. And, there were some people that were like, you know, involved in like sort of religious, like charity work. And so, you know, some people wanted to like, you know, build stoves for people like living in Ghana. And, you know, that's nice. But there was a real lack of imagination. And it just feels like the cycle of personal debt just really keeps people working and on a really sort of individualized track. And it makes it really hard for them to imagine what they would really want if survival wasn't something that was so in question. But what I got out of that, and that when I was doing that, that was probably in 2012 or maybe 2013. But the state of things are just really hard, I think, especially for everybody. But for people in cities, when rent is going up so much and wages are not, there's just this sense of like, maybe I'm not going to survive. And so, you know, the imagination is the first thing that kind of goes out the window. The imagination goes straight towards like, you know, your bank account and like, what are you going to do to sort of like shake off the feeling that you have from doing a job you don't believe in all day? So much less, you know, it makes it even harder for them to become involved in like sort of having a political imagination about the collective. And I think that there's so many other factors at work with the anxiety that people feel around survival, whether it's what's happening in the environment in the sense that they can't really get their head around what to be afraid of. I just feel like there's a sort of sense of impossibility and stasis, and everybody's little imaginations just gets like sort of like smaller and smaller and sort of like pushed to the periphery of their experience.
So what is the potential of debt to unite us, to bring us together, to bring people together who are suffering under debt, who are experiencing issues with debt and credit, which has kind of become, as I think a lot of your work shows or emphasizes, has become kind of a universal experience?
I don't know. I mean, I sort of standardly cite Annie McClanahan, who writes about social movements and debt, and she's an author that I see as being like really kind of ahead in terms of thinking about how debt really works, the potential of debt. Like, she really writes about the potential of debt in amazing ways. So she writes that when so many people have so much debt that they can never pay back, and there's just so many of us in that position, like the debt actually changes forms. And if it's no longer debt, maybe what it is just this like excuse for solidarity. And I think I still believe that. I think it's a really sort of slow process. But I do think that the process of untangling from our beliefs in and fear of financial institutions is ultimately like a really interdependent political process that I think a lot of us are in. And I think that there is a potential for actual forms of, like, new forms of solidarity to come from the degradation created by a debt system. I also think that there's a way that everyone, whether they have personal debt or not, is experiencing a really debt-ridden economic and social system. And I think it's a real challenge to figure out how to bring that out, because when we're talking about like municipal bonds, to pay for schools or to pay for city infrastructure. We're not each getting a bill in the mail for like the debt that your city incurs to like give you the basic infrastructure that you would expect, like sidewalks or libraries or sewers. Like we're not getting a bill for that, but we are all sort of experiencing the impacts of the debt system on the systems that we live with. So I think that there's a way that we're already sort of like in solidarity experiencing a lot of different forms of debt, ranging from personal to municipal. But I'm not exactly sure how to make it feel like solidarity when I think so much of what we experience of debt right now is completely invisible and buried. But I think it's a really important question to ask. I guess one thing that I've been thinking about a lot in the last couple of months is like, you know, we've really tapped into talking about student debt. And like, I think there's just a few years, we have like student debt movements that range in form, that reach all different populations. Like, it's totally amazing that we can talk about it now. We can talk about all the sort of injustices of, you know, various institutions, including educational ones. And that's totally amazing. But all in all, you know, there's all sorts of estimations about like how much money flows through, for example, like public higher education. Like maybe it's about like $60 billion for tuition for all public higher education. But okay, what about primary public education, like, you know, kindergarten through high school? Well, that's a $600 billion a year business. And so while we've all been really proud of our ability to talk about student debt in one way, about like our personal student debt and the way that that impacts, you know, jobs in the market, sure, like it's really important. But also, like, meanwhile, like babies are kind of entering a debt system. And so I find that there needs to be a whole new conversation about how this sort of undercurrent of debt can be exposed and still be used as a cause for solidarity. And I haven't seen how that can happen besides in places like Greece, Puerto Rico, and even in the Chicago public schools. But it's almost as if like that sort of underneath, like that public debt needs to actually like completely explode into bankruptcy or into some sort of like really crisis level situation before people begin to experience the solidarity that I think debt offers.
Cassie Thornton, she's an artist, a social practice artist whose work focuses on debt and security. She works under the title of the Feminist Economics Department, her creation, or the Fed. And we have a link to her website, the Feminist Economics Department, on our website, againstothegrain.org. Cassie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And this is CS suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against. Many thanks to Erica Bridgman, who's at the controls today.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.